I'd like to call the Environment Policy and Oversight Committee to order for March 26th. First thing we need to do, approve the March 24th meeting minutes. And Representative Hansen, would you like to move the minutes?
Move the minutes.
Representative Hansen moves the minutes for March 24th. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. We are first going to be hearing a bill offered by Representative Nelson. And I will move House File 519 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. And welcome, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and happy to be before your committee. Thanks for moving the bill. House File 519 is about non-conforming shoreland lots. And this bill came out of a working group that was set up last year by Representative Hillstrom, who at the time was the chair of the Local Government Committee. And it was trying to solve a problem that's been going on from what I've been told since 1972. And it's about non-conforming shoreland lots. Working with the DNR and interested work groups that in this committee, meetings were held over the interim to come up with a solution about trying to deal with these lots that don't conform with current rules and to minimize the impact on property and on the lakes and the streams. Even after the bill was drafted, we continued having meetings and we dealt with some of the issues that the builders had and the townships had and the cities and the counties. Currently, we've got, I'd say, 99% of the way there to peace in the valley on this. There's still an issue that the builders have with Section 1 of the bill that's dealing with, if it's possible, the bill is written, if it's possible to move it out of the shoreland impact zone, if the property is more than 50% destroyed, that they're going to try and do that, but if it's not possible to do that, they can build on their existing footprint that they're on now, and the builders just want to be able to build on that, and they're going to be up there to testify to that. I've got Ken Loxamol from here, from the DNR, who worked hard along on this bill, and to explain it and answer any questions that the members have. Now, there's also, during the interim, Representative Hillstrom asked for examples of lots to try and solve the majority of them. There were 14 examples that were brought forward. 9 of them were actual lots and properties. Of the 9 properties, or excuse me, there were 10 actual properties. Of the 10 properties, 9 of them were solved, at least wholly or partially. There's 2 of them, there was 3 out of them that they wanted to build 4 lots. They can get 3 out of the 4 lots. One of them, they just going to have to combine the 2 lots. But the rest of them, they were solved. They were able to, under the language of this bill, able to do it. Without this bill, these lots would not be able to be developed at all because they are non-conforming lots. They would not be able to build more than 1 lot on them. So this takes care of the majority of the problems that are out there currently today. And with that, I'll stand for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Any questions before we move on to Mr. Loxamol? Okay, seeing none, welcome Mr. Loxamol.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Kent Loxamol, Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. I think Representative Nelson did a good job of explaining this. We did have a number of meetings during the interim with the Association of Counties, League of Cities, and Townships, and the Realtors and the Builders. And we resolved all but, I think, one remaining issue, as was explained. As far as the environmental impact, the previous bills that were before the legislature in the last several years didn't have performance standards, essentially. They were bills that just allowed the sale of a non-conforming lot without any specifics. What we've developed here is something that provides specifics, that provides for adequate sewage treatment to protect water quality. That was one of our primary concerns. So this this bill still, we feel, protect the environment and is fair to the owners of some of these non-conforming lots. And this is dealing with both single non-conforming lots when you have 1 or 2 or more, and then also when you have non-conforming lots and they each have structures on them. And we've dealt with each of those individually. You could walk through the specifics in the bill if you'd like, Mr. Chairman, or I'll stand for questions.
We'll just stand for questions. So Are there any questions for Mr. Lockesmall or Representative Nelson? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lockesmall, if there's local ordinances that are more restrictive than the state ordinances, would this bill require, would it come into, how does it fit with local ordinances that may be more restrictive than general state ordinances or local lake ordinances?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, the, on line 2.25, this is the section that's dealing with in a group of two or more contiguous lots, which is the typical, the more typical problem. The bill says that the lot, oh, wait a minute, that's not the right, on line 2.23, excuse me, where we talk about the size, it is the lot size of shoreline classification consistent with Minnesota Rules Chapter 6120. That is the state standard.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lockesmall, so if a local lake had a 100-foot minimum, but state standard was different, it would be 66% of the state standard, not 66 feet of a local lake ordinance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, correct. Typically, the... yeah, the lot width is probably going to be 100 feet in both cases, but in that, it's 66% of the state standard, and the state standard for a general development lake is 100-foot lot width, so that would end up being 66 feet.
Representative McNamara.
So if I understand right, if you own less than 66 feet and your place burns down more than 50%, your history, would that be true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McNamara, no. If you have an individual lot and your place burns down, you can rebuild it on the same footprint. And what the language here talks about is if it's possible, if your cabin were less than 50% of the required setback, you can try to move it back if practicable. If you can't, you could build on the same footprint, but it doesn't allow expansion.
And Representative Dale.
Trying to get the same question as McNamara. Still don't get it. Trying to get it, but don't get it. So, give it to us again, please, rather than me asking the questions. I got to get my arms around this. Something doesn't add up. I don't get this, Eddie.
Well,
I mean, you get it, but I don't get it yet.
It's what I think he asked too was if it's. Could the county or the local unit of government have more restrictive rules? And I believe they can. Then the state rules, they can't be less restrictive. But as far as what he said about if it's in the shore impact zone and they can move it back, they can try and move it back. But if they can't move it back, if it's not possible, if you're moving into your drain field, if you're moving into that, it's not possible to move it back. You can still build it on the existing footprint that's there. But you can't expand it. So if you have a one-story house, you can't expand it to a two-story house. It can't go bigger than the actual footprint that's existing.
And Representative Dale.
It's the try to move it back part that I'm worried about. Who's going to decide when you can and can't, when you've tried? That's what I'd like to know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dale. That is a test that would be negotiated between the landowner and the local government.
Well, I think we could be negotiating it right here. Because I don't go for that business. I've had enough calls in my 7 years at the legislature that the local government is more like Stalin from time to time. And I think we could decide that right here, Representative McNamara. Or at least talk about it.
And as far as I guess you're saying as far as if it could be moved back, that would only be in the case if it was a certain percentage over the line towards beyond the setback. Is that correct? 50% you're saying? Or?
Mr. Chairman, there's three parts to this bill. One deals with existing nonconformities without considering whether or not there's other contiguous lots in ownership. It's just an existing structure on a non-conforming lot, a lot that doesn't meet the required zoning standards. Mm-hmm. If you have a structure on one of those lots that's located at less than 50% of the required setback, mm-hmm. and it were burned down or destroyed by a tornado or other natural act, what this requires, or I shouldn't say requires, what this encourages is that the setback be increased if practicable. Mm-hmm. And that determination would be between the, you know, they have to get a building permit anyway when to replace their structure, so that's a negotiation with the local zoning authority.
Okay.
The other two parts of this bill deal with multiple lots that are all too small and how those are combined. And then thirdly, with a if you have multiple lots, each with structures on them.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Dale?
Well, we went from try to encourage. That's what I heard you say. From tries to move it back to encourages to move it back. So I'm just wondering who's going to decide. I mean, encourage. I'm gonna let this go for a minute. I gotta read this some more and try and get it in my mind at least. I in my mind, what encourage is going to mean when it's applied locally.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Locke,
if I may, the actual language of concern, if I'm understanding Representative Beal correctly, it would be on lines starting on line 2.2. The structure setback must be increased if practicable, and reasonable conditions may be placed upon a zoning or building permit to mitigate created impacts. So if the must be increased if practicable, and that's a determination that would be done by local government through their local zoning process.
So,
and Representative Dale,
if the house burns down, they can set it on the same footprint unless it's practical to move it back.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dale, that is correct.
That's not my problem. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just wondering how much leeway there is for the local. It's completely up to the local unit and their zoning authorities to determine. Or, I mean, does practicable? Does that mean, you know, even if it might require a significant amount of cost and effort, it's still going to have to be done if it can be done? Or does it only mean if
in an earlier committee, Representative Eastland asked about the issue with insurance and the cost of that. And I checked with the Insurance Association, Bob Johnson, and he's going to get me information before it gets to the floor. He couldn't get me the language exact today, but he was telling me that if the house was more than 50% destroyed and it was practical to move it back and they were required to move it back, that the insurance would cover that cost. So that would be part of the insurance settlement. So if it's a large amount of money, that's part of the cost of moving it, of replacing the structure. But otherwise, if it's not practicable to move it back or possible, there's synonyms, and originally it was possible, but we changed it for comfort in another committee. But they said it could be built on the same footprint that it's at. So if you have a 20 by or a 26 by 30 house on or cabin on there, and it burned down, you could build a 26 by 30 cabin on that same footprint.
Okay. So, yes, Representative Dale.
Okay, I think I'm starting to get it here. I'm just going to tell you how I think it should be. And I made it work on an amendment if I get it all figured out. Is that if the house burns down, regardless of how much value is not burned or is burned, that it can be replaced on the same footprint unless the owner desires to move it back and forget the half the distance in the shoreline management bebop. I mean, the people got a house there and it gets burnt down or it gets blown over by a tornado, mm-hmm. why would we tell them that it must be moved if practical? I mean, it was already there.
I guess.
I know you're going to disagree with me on this, but I mean, the idea is that they already had it there, and it's no fault of their own that it burned out unless they torched it themselves. And God, and I mean, it's an act of God if a tornado or a hailstorm or a windstorm blows it over. It seems to me like this isn't right.
Yes, I do have a similar concern. For instance, if the house is just partially destroyed and it's up to 50% destroyed, is that correct? Talking about the, yeah. So, I mean, foundation could still be intact and so on, so it could be a substantial cost to move, but as you were saying, you're addressing the cost issue with insurance, would have to cover some of the costs in order for that setback to take place. Yeah, Representative Dill.
Well, insurance companies write insurance and charge for insurance based on how much they pay out. And so now we're going to write a zoning ordinance that's going to pay to move the house back if it's practical so that I can help pay that bill at a later time when I pay my next premium. I mean, they charge based on how much they pay out over a period of time. And now what you're saying is, the way I understand it, at least indirectly, is that the insurance company is going to pay to move a guy's house back because it might be practical, and then he's going to charge everybody in the neighborhood and across the state of Minnesota the cost of moving that house back. That's what I hear. I mean, maybe somebody can tell me, I don't know what I'm talking about. I've been told that before.
And Mr. Lockesmo.
And Representative Dill, the reason, I believe you asked, why would we want to do this? The reason is to, setbacks are in the existing ordinances for a reason, to provide better protection for the lake. And the homes aren't valuable, or the lake's not valuable because the homes are there. And we want to make sure that we protect the water quality and protect the lake. So increasing the setback can provide that. And it would be, there are a number of homes that are set back several feet from the lake. And if it's at all possible to move those back, if this kind of situation should occur, I believe we should do that. It's a better environment. It provides better environmental protection for the resource.
Representative Dill.
Well, I knew that's what you were going to say. So now I'm the guy down the street on Lake Vermilion who's got a $10 million house, which isn't that unusual. And I know, Mr. Lockesmo, you've seen a few of those on Lake Vermilion.
I have.
And now I'm the neighbor who has a 24x24 deer shack on the next property next door, and I know you've seen that before. So now the 24x24 shack is non-conforming, and so is the $10 million house.
Sounds like your bill's going to hinder arson, right? Can't get your lake-side property built where it was before if it burns down, right?
Well,
it's just getting a little too serious in here,
Minister. Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Gardner, the one part of the bill, though, is there's no expansion for this replacement if you're doing it after a fire. So it would be replacing exactly the same thing.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Joskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I'd like to thank Representative Nelson and Mr. Lockesmo for all your work on this. I know I was at one of the meetings over the summer that you had, and I know you folks have been working on this for a long time. I appreciate that. Question, on the bottom of page 2, item E, the notwithstanding and the conditions by which someone could still qualify. I'm wondering, I just want to be completely clear, and I did talk to Representative Nelson about this, and we thought that this language accommodated it, but if someone has the ability to put a holding tank that works correctly, I guess this question would be for Mr. Lockesmo, has a holding tank that is consistent with it, does that fit the language we have there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Joskowski, yes, this is for properties that you may own, two adjacent properties. They're non-conforming because they're too small, but if they each have septic systems that meet the requirements of the PCA Rule 78, which includes holding tanks for existing structures, then they are allowed to be sold.
Mr. Chair?
President Joskowski.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Lockesmo, it also says on the bottom of page 2, and the lots are suitable for or served by. So they wouldn't necessarily have to have the the tanks there, but have the suitability to locate them there. Is that correct? Mr. Lockerstone.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Grzelczyk, these are places that have a habitable residential dwelling. So I would expect that they have some type of sewage treatment in place. So maybe the suitable floor isn't needed or shouldn't be in there as I look at this, but the way it's written, it does say suitable floor.
Mr. Chair?
And Representative Gaskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Lockesmore, I would lobby for it to stay in there. The particular nonconformance in my district has a building that's habitable on one lot but not occupied, and then another building on the other lot that is occupied and does have a septic system that I'm sure conforms with the law. So I will guess there'd be those kinds. So given the language, the interpretation there looks like they would merely have to be suitable for. Is that correct?
Yes. That's correct.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? I see none. No amendments. We do have anyone else that wants to testify?
I believe Lisa Furnett from the Builders wants to come down and...
Ms. Furnett.
Speak on the bill.
Welcome, Ms. Furnett.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Lisa Furnett with the Builders Association in Minnesota. I appreciate the fact that you didn't let us speak up and testify on just the one short provision, and it's the provision that Representative Field has been speaking to. We feel that if a homeowner or somebody's structure burns down or is devastated due to some sort of peril, that they ought to be able to build on that footprint the same as you can in language above if they do it within the 180 days and they file for their permit, as long as they don't go beyond the extent of the footprint which was originally built.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Burnett. Any questions of Ms. Burnett? Okay. And Representative Dale.
Okay. And thank you. I think this is for Mr. Lockesmore. If you have a septic system that's non-conforming, but you have a... isn't there some kind of... I think there's a certificate that allows you to continue to use it even though it's non-conforming. I think. And your house burnt down more than the 50%. Can the local unit of government make you put in a new septic system then before you can rebuild? And would you have to move the house back from its original foundation?
Mr. Lockesmore.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bill, I would have to direct that question to PCA. They administer those rules. 70-80 are the standard. You know, and basically the standards are built around for on-site systems for a regular drain field. And holding tanks are type 2 systems, and they're allowed and permitted under the rules for existing structure. But if you had a vacant lot and you were putting in a structure or putting in a sewage treatment system, they would be looking at doing a drain field, and current regulations require you to have 2 sites for potential drain fields. But specifically to answer that question, I would have to get advice from CPA.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Okay, any other questions or discussion? No amendments? Okay. With that, I will renew the motion then that House File 519 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you. And next we have House File 1674, Representative Hausman. and Representative Hausman, I will move House File 1674 be recommended to pass and refer it to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. And I do, everyone should have also a delete all amendment, the DE1 amendment. And I will also move the DE1 amendment to get it in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Hausman, welcome to the committee, and this bill is amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, you'll notice that Hausman and Eakin were authors of that first bill, and I think both of us thought we were bringing something forward that didn't have a lot of controversy, but we found out that wasn't the case. We stepped back. And the amendment that you just adopted suggested there is some interim work that needs to be done. We took some good advice from Representative Wagenius and said we're not ready for those percentages yet, and so that portion of the bill is no longer before you. House File 1674 provides for the disposition of receipts for the dedicated Parks and Trails Fund. As you know, last fall, the Minnesota passed that constitutional amendment to increase the general sales tax, and some of this money is dedicated to support parks and trails of regional or statewide significance. This bill was suggesting some operating principles that I think we probably all agree on, and that is that as we distribute these tax dollars, we need to be fair and equitable throughout the state. Systems need to be treated equally to maintain balance, and we should have some sort of agreement on what parks of statewide and regional significance are, and so there's some direction for a proposed definition that will be worked on. What you have before you now is there is still a distribution formula, but it is only for the metropolitan area. The implementing agencies in the metropolitan area work together. There was agreement on this from 10 of the 11 implementing agencies. They kind of don't want to start over, and so that's the language you see before you. Greg Mack is here from Ramsey County. If you have specific questions, clearly we assume that as we invest this money, we are going to provide an enhanced visitor service and access. We're going to accelerate the management of the restoration and protection of natural landscapes. We're going to accelerate facility maintenance and rehabilitation, and perhaps acquire and develop new facilities. We hope there's some sort of reporting to the legislature as this goes along on usage and expenditures. So you note there's a mechanism just now dedicated to metro regional parks. The bill does raise some significant questions, and our discussions raise some significant questions. The distribution formula among all the players, the definition of statewide or regional significance. They're hard discussion points, and inevitably the House and the legislature are going to need to face the issues, but to move this bill forward and in order to provide a better forum in which these issues can be resolved, the amendment suggests a working group of all the stakeholders to deal with these questions that reports back to the legislature. And while the initial bill offered some ideas of how to define regional parks, that also is something that the working group is asked to come up with, a proposal that they make back to the legislature. I understand it's the intent of those working on the amendment not to establish dedicated percentages in law at this time, to await results of the stakeholders group. I can see merit in that approach. Long term, I do believe that the best use to which we can put these resources will be by allowing the park agencies who deliver the product to the citizens to know that they have a stable and dependable source of revenue to make long term plans and to implement those plans. If you have a steady job, you can plan to buy a car, a house, and raise a family. If our park agencies know they have resources available, they can plan for a better park future. Our state park system is well over 100 years old and is a tremendous asset to the state in terms of the health of our citizens. These parks are critical in terms of tourism, recreation, attracting new residents and businesses.
and there is a growing need to establish regional parks in other parts of the state. So while we are funding existing needs, we're also looking to the future. Over 55% of the state's population now lives in the Seven County metro area. It's also where 64% of the sales tax dollars go. I mention this to talk about the incredible stress that this dense population has on our metro parks. I can just talk about my specific one, Como. We've reached capacity in cars. There is no longer on the weekends in the major season any place to park your car. And I personally have had the experience of promising I was taking my grandchildren to a destination that never existed. We ended up going back home. So in May, to deal with that stress on that particular park, we are actually starting up remote lots and shuttles. Because millions of people are coming to this park, and we don't want them to be discouraged because they can't find a place to park their car. I want to say just a little bit about, I think it's not unusual that we've had so much emotion and debate about this, because it has to do with a couple of things. It does have to do ultimately with property taxes. I can give you a little bit of a sense of the impact in two cities. In 2007, St. Paul property taxpayers spent $13 million, almost $14 million property tax dollars on their regional parks. In 2008, they spent over $14 million in property tax dollars on their regional parks. In Minneapolis, that number was $19 million for Minneapolis regional parks. And in the entire metropolitan area, the number is, I believe, $86 million in property taxes. So you see that we are certainly already putting a huge effort into this. So it does have to do with one of those unpopular taxes, property tax. The stress on the parks as a result of the heavy population and heavy use is there. And the agreement we now all have among all of the parks in the state is that equity and not percentages are a more important outcome. We were going to have more testimony, but you have many bills, but I believe Judy Erickson is here, and if you wanted her to say that she's supportive of the amendments that you see before you on this bill and the next, she's here. I believe there's somebody from Dakota County, and I have Greg Mack from Ramsey County, if you would like to say just a few words.
Okay. And welcome, Mr. Mack. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Greg Mack. I'm Director of Parks and Recreation for Ramsey County. As Representative Hausman outlined, what I have in front of you as a packet has changed. I mean, obviously, the amendment position. I'm going to take a couple of minutes to just highlight a few points. There is a packet that you have. It was a PowerPoint that we've dispensed with. Fundamentally, the Metropolitan Regional Park System has been in existence since 1974, and we are a part of the state. We became an entity of the state when you established us and charged the Metropolitan Council to plan a regional park, said the agency should manage those, and that's what we do. Currently, there's 11 implementing agencies. We have acquired since 74, assembled a 53,000 acre system of parks, again, throughout the Seven County metropolitan area, made up of park reserves, regional parks, regional trails that are all interconnected. We serve 33 million visitors a year, and that's been from 74, where we just were in our infancy with 5 million, we're up to that 33 million range. As Representative Hoffman indicated, local property tax pays for a lot, and that's reflective of the fact that we have about 50% of our use comes from the local jurisdiction. About 40% of that comes from other parts of our state, and then the balance comes from further afar. So we do serve a regional function. The state has recognized that through previous funding formulas on how we come together and finance all parts of our system. we're guided by plans. And what we do, the Metropolitan Council has a 2030 plan that is a vision for the whole region. Parks is an integral part of that plan. For each regional park, we have a master plan, and out of those, we develop capital improvement programs, and those capital improvement programs are implemented by the agency. We have in what was, or is, 1674, we wanted to focus on some key areas. Land acquisition, but really looking at those threatened parcels. So we were suggesting we need to look at having resources available to address emergency land acquisitions. It's not the ongoing stage stuff, it's the emergency acquisitions we can connect with. Visitor services, we know that we can do better at improving those visitor contacts, so that's an integral part. Natural resource restoration. We hold 53,000 acres. Many of those are premier regional park acreages that are managed as prairies, wetlands, upland areas. We need to focus better on that. Our facilities were 1974 is when we became a system, but a lot of our pieces existed before that. We need to look at rehabilitation and maintenance of that, continuing to have that investment work for the state. And then some new facility development to enhance the services. We prepared a prioritized list, and we have a list of projects that should be done under those principles. We look at very clear, measurable outcomes for each of those. They're based on our plans. They're based on our master plans, and they're really aimed at implementing that 2030 plan that's part of the Metropolitan Program. On page 6 of the handout I had, there's a summary document that just gives you a little spreadsheet of how that is broken out. I want to just point out one thing, that in that, this was based on a biennial appropriation. I know that came from the way that it's going, but about 25% of the total was going to be underwritten by non-state funds. So we would look at leveraging other funds to implement these projects. So it's just an important part of what we do. So just to close, what we do is we've been operating systems for 35 years. We've been in the business, some of us, much longer than that, not individually, but systems have been there. I may have been individually. And we have been successful. We've been transparent, and we've been accountable to you throughout all of that. We've reported through several different mechanisms. So we do appreciate your time to look at this. I know it's a very important policy issue. It's an important, eventually, a financing issue for all of us, and we do appreciate the attention you're giving.
And, Mr. Chair, we didn't distribute it to the whole committee because it's rather large, but we do actually have a sufficient copies of this, particularly if you happen to be in the metro area, of all of the potential projects that are on the table. So that is available. I'm not certain who has the... So if there are members of the committee, we do have a group of those, but it's a lot of paper. So, Mr. Chair, I brought this on behalf of a number of groups who worked very hard, and as you can see, there is huge love of these parks and heavy use of them and great need, and so I bring this on their behalf.
Thank you, Representative Hausman, and thank you, Mr. Mack. Any questions? Representative Gardner.
I was just going to comment, Mr. Chair. I'm really happy to see this bill. I appreciate that very much. I'm in the suburbs, and we have a great regional park system in my neck of the woods in Anoka and Ramsey County, which I'm going to keep secret for everybody because they're so cool. But this bill will help take some pressure off our state parks also, because people have a wide variety of services. This just isn't places to go walking, but there's camping and boating and other facilities in the metro area that we're going to take care of with this bill. And I think that will help reduce some of the stress in our state assets also.
And for all of you who may have been discouraged about Como Park, remember in May there's going to be a remote lot and some shuttles. So we'll make it a little easier for you to enjoy at least that one.
Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, you used the words emergency land acquisition. I've never heard that before. How would you describe that, or what is that?
Mr. Mack.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have within all of our regional park areas, there's a master plan. It defines the boundaries for each regional park that's approved by the local units. So in our case, Ramsey County would be every municipality where we are. As properties become available for purchase, let's say it's going to be subdivided, or it might maybe a residential parcel that would become available for purchase that's key to the operation of the park, we then have a resource to go to be able to respond to the need at that moment. I call it emergency, officially we call it an acquisition opportunity fund, and under the Metropolitan Council framework, what we have done is 60% of the, under this, 60% of the cost of that fund has been funded by the Metropolitan, or by the state, and 40% by the Metropolitan Council. In addition, there's a 25% match that's provided by the local unit. So we're really trying to respond to those things that come up that we can't look out and have a five-year takedown kind of a purchase agreement, but those that come up that we know they're in the plan and we want to respond. And today, more and more people are coming to us because of the economic condition and say, are you ready? And some of us have to say, we are not ready today because we don't have the resources in our pockets.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hausman and Mr. Mack. Question under Clause 4 on page 1. You talk about 10% of money used for grants through the Met Council. The match there, a $2 bond match for every $3 of state funds, is the mere construct of that. Does it have the potential to call for additional bond funds from the Met Council just because of the fact that there's state money from the 3/8 Amendment coming into this this program?
Mr. Mack.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this is the formula the Metropolitan Council has used. They have defined what their limits of bonding would be, and within that, their limits, the Met Council has defined, there would be sufficient funding to match this as it was originally proposed. We had 10% of an appropriation level, the way this was constructed on line, what's on line 1.20.
And I think, Mr. Mack, the question was if there is more money coming in as a result of the amendment. Was that your question?
Oh, yes.
The additional demands on Met Council match. I think that was...
We have worked with the Legislative Commission on Minnesota Resources to try to provide some funding in this area. There is additional capacity to do that. If I could refer you to page 6 of the handout, the first item that's listed under that on that spreadsheet, the land acquisition, this was based on a number, but it gives you the example. This would bring in $1.8 million of funding from the Metropolitan Council to match the state appropriation under this amount. In addition, we do reach out to the implementing agencies to participate at a 25% level. Did that address your question?
Representative Duskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mack, it partially does. I'm just wondering, maybe just a follow-up or a related question would be, given the fact, assuming this is implemented and adopted in the law, given the fact that Clause 4 appears there and is part of the plan, the way it's written, would the additional money coming in from the 3/8 Amendment provide for a higher level of bonding within Met Council because of the 3/8 money coming into the system?
Mr. Mack,
relative to what they are now.
This is within the threshold that's been established with the numbers that were originally in the bill. If you thought that to double the appropriation to the regional park system, we would have to work with the Metropolitan Council about raising their bond limit in this area. They have the capacity. It's just been a policy issue. We would have to bring that to them at a higher level. Thank you.
And welcome to the committee. If you could state your name for the record, please.
Yes, my name is Arnie Stifford. I'm on the staff of the Metropolitan Council and their Parks Program. In regards to your question, but the answer is that it could require the council to issue more than it has in the past of bonds for this particular purpose. And there is a limitation in statute as to how much the council can issue for park purposes, and that's $40 million of outstanding bonds can be issued at any point in time. So there is a possibility that that limit could be reached depending upon whatever the appropriation is at some point in the future.
Thank you. Just one last follow-up, and thank you for that clarification. Would it be the intent, or maybe you can't see out that far, that should that scenario play out, would it be the intent that the Met Council is going to come back to legislature and ask for additional bonding authority beyond what they're provided for in statute currently?
Mr. Chair, members, I really can't speak on behalf of the council regarding that question of whether they would ask for more authority beyond the limitation that's in statute. I can't speak for them on that.
Thank you for your testimony. And we are starting to get in some areas that local government would deal with or finance, but thank you for your testimony. And
I will just answer that last part. Legislators might oppose lifting that cap because it would mean we'd have to pay more property taxes. So I think it would be more likely the legislators that would limit Met Council. Again, just speaking of that property tax burden, we watch that pretty carefully. So, Mr. Chair, I believe that concludes our testimony. And my understanding is you, Mr. Chair, agree with the direction that the delete all took, and that's a better way to move the bill forward. And
I do, Representative Hausman, and I thank you for working with us. And I think we all have the same goal in mind, which is, we understand this is one state, and we should develop one vision for where we want to be in 25 years as far as our park system is concerned. And Representative Hausman have been working very hard in trying to come up with that common vision. And so I appreciate that very much in trying to draw all the stakeholders in and make sure all of our needs are being met. One concern that I had, and you talked about the local contributions in the metropolitan area, the property taxes that are being paid to support your park system, which I think is admirable, and I think that it's a great thing that you're doing and investing in. Unfortunately, there are some areas of the state that don't have the same amount of resources to draw upon, and I guess my concern is with one sentence, and I was just thinking of offering an oral amendment on page 3, line 3.7, striking the words.
Mr. Chair, are you on the delete all?
I am, on the DE one. And it would be, again, on page 3, line 3.7, to strike the word significant. The reason I wanted to do this, I do have concerns about some of those areas that don't have significant resources to draw upon, and I don't want them to be placed at a disadvantage here.
I would totally agree with that.
Right. Okay. Thank you, Representative Hausman. And it still would say local contribution, because I think that's important that there be local efforts put forward, and local contribution can also mean sweat equity as well. But I would move that oral amendment. Any questions or comments on that? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying yes or aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails and amendment is adopted. So, well, thank you, Representative Hausman. And are there any further questions? Seeing none, I will then renew the motion that House File 1674. As amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative Hausman. And Representative Haas. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Representative Haas, and I will move...
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I will move House File 1976 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. And Representative Haas, thank you for your work on this and to the
thank
bill.
You. It's an honor to be here. We also have an amendment. You're going to move the amendment also, Mr.
And
Chair?
I will. I will move the DE2 amendment. And then, maybe Representative Haas, there is the same language again on the page 2. I was wondering if we could just incorporate striking the word significant. On line 2.8, where it requires significant local contribution.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Haas.
Outstate significance is larger than a metro significance, by the way, but that'll be for a different discussion. You can strike it, Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
Okay, so we will incorporate that into the DE2 amendment. And this is to get bill into the shape and form that the author would like.
Thank you.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
Thank you.
Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Haas to the bill as amended.
I think, Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm the person that got the bill to be controversial. And the first comment when I'm saying that is that's really not a flippant comment because the grants on the outside in Greater Minnesota, when we apply for the grant, it's usually a 25% match. And so there is differences as we go. There's been three bills floating around here. And the sticklers of the bills have been the percentages and where that is going to be spent. The governor's bill had 24% spent on regional parks. And that was regional parks all the way through the state of Minnesota. And we improved on that by my side of the penny. We spent 24%, but it's regional parks outside the metro because... In our controversy, when we look at it, we think Metro's eating a couple times out of the apple. Metro, however, is on the other side of the penny, and they're looking at tails, and I'm looking at heads, you know, and they got 10% going to all regional parks. I didn't like that as much. So we're struggling with that process, and we start to recognize that there is a Minnesota. And the significance should be attached to regional parks no matter where they're at. Somebody said, you know, this has been around for 32 years. I ran one of the largest outstate regional systems in St. Cloud for 32 years. Somebody said, you know, this is almost 100 years old. St. Cloud has the oldest city park in the state of Minnesota. Dedicated in 1854. At that time, it was called Central Park because the only park they knew of was Central Park in New York. So these places have been playing big time in this. By the way, Stearns County and St. Cloud, when the funding formulas kick in, you have metro parks and you have state parks. In my district, which I can speak of, we have neither. So it's really hard to get into the funding formula. But I think we now have, with this amendment, we have a glass half. And if this body is listening and our people involved in this are speaking, we have a glass half full. When we quit listening and these people from outstate quit speaking, we have a glass half empty. Let me tell you what this amendment does. The Commissioner of National Resources will start a grants program, and he's going to develop, the Commissioner will develop a 10-year plan on a 25-year framework. We're going to develop a definition of regional significance in parks, and that definition has to be pretty good, and it also should be flexible enough in case it's messed up.
because if it has unintended consequences, it's a very dangerous definition. But LCMR, we've been working off an LCMR definition for a long time, so that's a good base for it. We want to have a plan and a recording of increased participation. Now, in outstate parks, we may not even have a gate. You enter the park wherever you want to enter the park from. So it's not as easy to count as if you actually have an official entrance. Many outstate parks, you just enter them where you can get into them. We have a plan to connect our trails. And connecting trails are very important, and connecting trails are not, it's not happening. We have people in outstate, in Greater Minnesota, taking a bike on a car to get to a trail because there's no connectors. Whether that is trails with rails or however it does, it's going to be studied in this plan. These trails also should be connected to commuter systems. We've taken out significant local match. By the way, we're so used to it in Greater Minnesota, it didn't bother me when it was in there, because we've been doing significant matches for a long, long time. We're going to have this 10-year plan and a 25-year vision or a 25-year framework. We're going to have that by October 1st, 2010. My internal feelings when I started expressing that to other park people in the outstate, we had 27 county park professionals sign on and said we have similar feelings. This was not hard sell either. That was explaining our side of the penny and saying, this is what we see. Oh, we see that too. That is not without, no recruiting, no hard door knocking, no lobbying. 27 counties see the side of the penny like I do. They're park professionals. So I would ask you, this is a time that we can change Minnesota into one Minnesota park system. We can listen, and they can speak, and we can make a difference going into the future. When we do that, it's not a 25-year future. It's a lifetime future. Some areas, such as the area I can speak of, will have 200,000 more people living in St. Cloud area in 2020. What type of open spaces will be left if we don't give those types of areas a plan to help with the regional park? With me tonight, I have the Stearns County Park Director, Chuck Wolfen, and he has been spearheading this ad hoc uprising that is now so peacefully united in this bill. Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
My name is Chuck Wilkins, Stearns County Park Director, and it's always hard to follow Larry.
I go slow enough.
The reason that the number is on the bill is that that's when Larry was my geometry teacher, and he was a better teacher than I was a student. With me today is Mark Matthijs, Wright County Park Director, and Barry Wendorf, Sandy County Park Director. They're here to help answer any questions that you may have. We represent Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trail Providers. I hope you received a handout there. There's a map on the handout that shows in green the number of the counties that have supported increased funding and recognition of Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails. And as Representative Hodge referred to, we didn't have to do very much door knocking because one of the key words in the constitutional amendment was that you can't supplant. And we're so used to getting nothing, we don't have to worry about that language. In 2008, only $850,000 was available for the $37 million worth of grant applications that came in from Greater Minnesota Regional Park and Trail Providers. Now, we are all Minnesotans, and I think the coalition that is represented on that handout recognizes that we all have needs, but that we're all into providing public outdoor recreation opportunities together. A study that was done by the DNR in 2007 showed that 47% of the visitors to state parks were from the metro region. In 2004, another study showed in outdoor recreation participation that 67% of all outdoor recreation happens within 67% of all the outdoor recreation hours happens within 30 minutes of home. And in the metro, if you're driving, trying to get there at 3 o'clock, between 3 and 6, I'm sure the park may have to be within 2 miles to get there within 30 minutes. Because of that close-to-home access to nature, that's why there are Greater Minnesota Regional Parks, to provide the same type of facilities that metro parks provide to all the citizens in Minnesota. Greater Minnesota Park and Trail providers seek your support in an equitable distribution of the Park and Trail Fund to meet all Minnesotans' needs.
Thank you, Mr. Wilkin. Any questions? Representative Drozdowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd ask for some clarifications maybe from Representative Hauser or the Chair. We just approved Representative Hausman's bill. This seems, at least, is it identical from one point in her bill forward? And what is the utility in this bill at this point? We've got quite a bit of an agenda ahead of us. Just thought I'd ask those questions.
Yeah, and the bills do differ in one regard. There is no reference to the metro parks and the formula that was in Representative Hausman's bill. Otherwise, there is identical language here. But the reason we're sending two of them out is we want to continue the working relationship between the rural and the metro. Representative Hausman on one bill, Representative Haas on the other. We want a working relationship between the two regions of the state, and because we want that common vision. So we want both of them to be working on it as this bill moves forward. So, and I don't know, Representative Haas, if you wanted to respond at all.
I really do think it's a matter of a changing attitudes of and silos and starting to work with one Minnesota, and so I would really appreciate moving two bills at this time.
Okay. Any other questions at all? Seeing none, Mr. Wilkin, thank you for your testimony. Just thought I'd mention that I've spent a great deal of time in the quarry park near St. Cloud, which because I taught Representative Haas's son in that area, so lived there for many years. So, but thank you for coming today, and thank you, Representative Haas.
Thank you, committee.
Again, thank you so much for your work on this.
I will
renew. I will renew the motion that House File 1967, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Okay. Next, we have Representative Scalzi, House File 1991. I will move House File 1991 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. And Representative Scalzi, welcome back to the committee and to the bill.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and it is great to be back. I spent a number of years on this committee, and I do kind of miss it. It's been fun watching you in action tonight. You also have in your packets a DE2 amendment, and that's what we'd be working on tonight. So if you would move that, Mr. Chair.
I will do that. I will move the DE2 amendment to get the bill in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted, and Representative Scalzi to the bill as amended.
Yes, and you also have in your packet a fact sheet that's called the Characterization of an Emerging Issue in Minnesota. And it's kind of a complex issue, and I have people here with me, but this might help you understand a little bit better. This bill is based upon, it relates to the stormwater holding ponds and some of the problems with the contaminated mud in the bottom of those holding ponds. And I brought the bill forward because of a PCA request to the LCCMR for funding, and they weren't funded. So what this bill details some of the problem. It's got three sections. It details some of the problems, details how the PCA could work with local governments to work on this problem, and then there's also an appropriation from the Clean Water Fund. But the policy part of the bill is what we're talking about tonight, and that addresses the issue to prevent the additional pollution of these stormwater holding ponds, whether they're constructed, man-made constructed, or natural wetlands which are used as stormwater holding ponds. And basically it deals with driveway sealants, the sealants that you put on your driveway and your parking lot. There's two types. One type is an asphalt type, and that's what MnDOT usually uses as a seal coating. There's another type that's a coal tar, an undiluted coal tar sealant, and that's mainly used in the Midwest and the East Coast, and the asphalt type is typically used on the West Coast. And there's a number of cities who have created ordinances related to the use of these seal coating products. So the bill in the first part directs state agencies to not purchase the product that research shows may be a pollutant that may contribute to the PAH contamination. That's a hydrocarbon, because it's difficult to dispose of and treat. And also the bill in Section 2 starts with a notification process for state and local officials. And I have with me here tonight two people that understand this issue very well. They're both from the PCA. I have Lisa Thorvig, who's the Municipal Division Director, and Dr. Judy Crane, who is a research scientist who has worked on this issue both here in the state and also nationally. This is not a department bill, but we have worked together for a start to a solution of this emerging issue, and that's how we came up with the DE2 amendment. So if you have any questions, they're here to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. And any questions at all? Okay, I see none. And do you have any comments that you would like to make?
Actually, no. But did you want to make any comments?
We do have one other person who would like to testify. Ms. Greg Johnson. Welcome, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson, representing the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank Representative Stolze for bringing this issue forward. We had actually started hearing about it recently due to a city that had a very severe problem with finding these contaminants in the sludge as they were trying to do normal upkeep and maintenance, removing the silt from a stormwater pond, and found out it had to be disposed of as hazardous waste because this material was in it. $500,000 later, they cleaned up a stormwater pond that they thought they just had to dredge out. And we're expecting we will see more of that. So in general, we do very much support more study on this to find out what the causes are, see if this is an effective way to deal with it. We do not have information right now, and we appreciate the DE2 amendment addressed several of our concerns with the original bill. We don't know how frequently these coal tar sealants are being used by municipal governments in street maintenance. We expect that most of the street work is using asphalt sealant, but parking lots and other areas maintained by cities, we're not sure what they're using, and we're still trying to gather information on that. So this study, I think, will help determine that information. We do have just one general concern that this bill isn't meant to recognize, but I want to raise it for the committee's purposes. One is the definition of stormwater ponds. That's not really a defined term. I think we'll have to work on that as the bill moves forward to be more clear what we mean. But as an example, coal tar sealants are used on driveways. And everybody who's putting in a rain garden right now is going to have coal tar sealants in the sediment under that rain garden if they have an asphalt driveway that's been paved with coal tar or sealed with coal tar sealants. So this doesn't only affect the big ponds that people build their houses next to. It's going to affect all of our stormwater management places that collect sediment. And secondly, there's kind of a standing issue that cities have an ongoing concern about. It's a misunderstanding people have that these little ponds in their backyards are waters for their dogs to fetch in and their kids to wade in and to put a canoe in. They can catch some little bullheads in, and they aren't. These are pollution control places, they're actually meant to consolidate the contaminants in the stormwater to keep them from getting to our lakes and rivers. And so we do have a concern. We want to make sure that as this moves forward, that yes, we do want to make sure that when we're cleaning these facilities up, that it's done right and that we're getting these contaminants out. We definitely want to make sure that if coal tar sealants are causing it, this would be a very, very expensive problem for cities that we stop using them. But we also want to make sure that people are aware that these waters are meant to be pollution control devices, and that we'll deal with the cleanup as quickly and efficiently and safely as we can.
Okay. Mr. Johnson and Representative Wagenius.
Yes, I just wanted to check with you again on that the dollar amount it took to clean up the one.
And that pond was in White Bear Lake, and that was actually in the Pioneer Press, so this has been kind of brought to the forefront by the press. It was $500,000. And I spoke with the people at, and that was one pond. I spoke with the people at White Bear Lake this week, and they're just sort of in a holding pattern, excuse the pun, but they're in a holding pattern because they're just wondering what to do in the future. And they're not testing any more ponds because, of course, once you test them and find this PAH, you almost have to do something with it. And there's many cities that are going to have to be dealing with this, I think, in the future. And the PCA work that they would be doing to on a pilot project would really give us some hope for the future, maybe some ideas of how we can deal with this in the future.
Any other? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Scalzi, do you know, would these be some of the popular sealants that homeowners use in their 5-gallon buckets? Are some of those, if I'm not mistaken, some of that stuff is not asphalt-based. Is it coal-based when they are, if I'm not mistaken, if I can ask that first?
Representative Scalzi.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative McNamara. In the central states and on the east coast, coal tar has been used for this type of sealant. And I just checked at my local hardware store, and everything that they had of last year's product was asphalt. But this year's product was not in yet because this is Minnesota, and they looked at me sort of crazy, like, what would I want a driveway seal coating for at this time of the year? But we're not really sure, and we didn't really want to address the issue of people purchasing it at this time. We're just trying to get the issue brought to the forefront and get the PCA on board with their studies.
And if I could follow up, in your discussions with the public agencies, did they acknowledge that they used to use this kind of a product and it is not... they're not using it anymore? I'm wondering, do we know where the PAHs came from?
Okay, if you could state your name for the record.
Hi, if
you could repeat that for the tape, that would be great.
Hi, I'm Dr. Judy Crane from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, where I'm a research scientist. Could you repeat the question one more time, please?
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Crane, I'm wondering, do we know the history? Did our municipalities used to use a coal tar sealant, and would we have any way of knowing, like, if some communities did, or was MnDOT using it?
Doctor?
I think MnDOT probably used to use it, but they have a policy now that with their contracts that they are just using asphalt-based sealant. I'd like to add that over in Wisconsin, that Dane County, Wisconsin, has banned coal tar sealant. In Austin, Texas, they have banned coal tar sealant. And then just back in a few months ago in December, Washington, D.C. has banned coal tar-based sealant. So there is a movement to ban these products, and it may be more, I think, more helpful to take more of a statewide approach with trying to reduce the usage of these products than going piecemeal by different communities.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then Dr. Crane, do we have a agency standard for a level of PAH where it becomes hazardous waste and is not able to be disposed of in a less costly manner?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative. The agency has different values that they use. We have sediment quality guidelines that are used as benchmark values to compare the chemical concentrations of these PAH compounds to the likelihood that they may impact the bottom feeding critters. We have, if the sediments are going to be dredged and disposed on land, we have soil reference values for the protection of human health, but then those values would be compared to. The remediation staff at the agency have other values that they may be using in terms of coming up with remediation or cleanup goals. But I think with anything land disposed, they would be comparing them to the soil reference values for the protection of human health.
Okay. And any other questions?
Mr. Chair, yes. and Representative McNamara, what I want to...
For the record, please.
Lisa Thorvig, Division Director of the Municipal Division. The reason that we're here is because we actually proposed the LCCMR study, which is really embodied in paragraph C, section 2, paragraph C of this bill, to identify and develop best management practices, to both figure out a way to do screening analysis so we can identify ponds that are high in these PAH compounds, and then also figure out ways to treat and dispose of these contaminated sediments in a more cost-effective way than what the city of Wager Lake had to go through. And so the heart of this bill, in my opinion, is doing this research that needs to be done, both in terms of how you screen and test in a cost-effective, low-cost way, and then what are the ways we can deal with these contaminated sediments so it isn't so expensive. And so that's what the money will go for, is to do this research, so that then when in paragraph D, it talks about we'll use this information, the inventory information and this research information, in the next permit that we develop for municipal stormwater regulated entities. And so by putting in a permit, then the regulated community will have a chance to weigh in and have due process, and we'll come to an agreement. So I think it does make sense. I think, as Mr. Johnson said, we still need to tighten up maybe some definitions so it doesn't feel too big beyond what we intended to cover in this bill.
Okay. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Thorvig, but what I was wondering, do we have a number now, like a 2.1? How did we determine in White Bear that they couldn't put it on land? How was that determination made? Were you guys part of that process?
Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we were part of that process. I don't have that specific information, but it was assessed according to our hazardous waste rule. And I don't know if there's a specific number for PAH compounds, but there's also toxicity testing that's required to identify whether sediments are hazardous waste or not. So pursuant to our hazardous waste rules, this material tested as hazardous waste. There's other studies going on right now. We're about a year away from a study to see if it can be used in compost. So there's other work being done that we want to look at and see if there's other ways to handle this.
And the Representative Wiskowski, did you have a question?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I may have missed some of the discussion. Representative McNamara talked about land application. Can this be remediated through land application similar to, are hydrocarbons similar to oil or gasoline infected soil? That would be one question. The other one I wonder what the first section of the bill prohibits any state agency from using this. That question would be, what is the alternative for whatever uses they normally would be used for? and what type of additional cost are we going to be seeing to state government because of that?
Ms. Thurvig.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'll answer your second question, and I'll let Dr. Crane answer the question about the land application. The first section of this bill says, puts a prohibition for state agencies to purchase undiluted coal tar sealant. There are two types of sealants that are out there commercially available. One is coal tar based and the other is asphalt based. What we all also are finding is that there is a new sealant coming out that is a combination of a small percentage of coal tar and a higher percentage of asphalt that seems to have better properties as a sealant. So this language prohibits only the undiluted coal tar. It doesn't prohibit the asphalt base, and it doesn't prohibit the combination. It also the representative put in a date of July 1st, 2010, so this gives a year for us to work with other sister agencies to see if there are problems. We've already talked to MnDOT. MnDOT is feeling that they are already meeting this requirement, so it's not a problem for them, and they're probably our biggest user of this kind of thing in the state. But if there is a problem, we'll be able to come back next session and talk about it, which is why we put the date out for when this takes effect to July 2010. We haven't done all the research on that issue.
And Mr. Chair and Representative.
And Dr. Crane.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
In regards to your first question, was I believe it was whether just applying the contaminated sediments to land could actually result in some remediation, some reduction in the level of pHs. There could be some occurring that way due to microbial degradation of the pHs. pHs are formed by combustion products from coal-based products, and also there's petroleum sources of pHs, and these pHs comprise a group of over 100 different compounds, and some of them are very volatile, and some of them like to stick to sediment, so that's why we oftentimes see them in the bottom of lakes and ponds. They like to be on the sediment. So depending on how bad some of the pH compounds are, they may not degrade very quickly if they're applied on land. The other problem with applying them on land is that some of these compounds are carcinogens, so they can cause toxic effects to terrestrial invertebrates or up the food chain that may be on that land. So there's an ecological risk component to it.
And Dr. Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You mentioned that the MnDOT is not going to be using these coal tar sealants anymore. Have our cities and county departments been advised to also go away from using these kinds of sealants?
Mr. Chair and Representative, we have not done that with this bill. The only thing we've done with this bill is in preparation for, say, a bonding bill or something like that, where we're putting money into correction of driveways and parking lots. We simply want to present what we can from the state's level. But I think it could go to that level. I think what we want to do is get finished with the research that we need to have done as far as what to do with it, and I think we'll be back next year with possibly cities and other local units of government, because the League of Minnesota Cities is very aware of this situation, and they would like us to move forward with it as well. So this is kind of the starting point, and we thought we'd start with the state first rather than get involved in a lot of other controls and other areas.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I know your agenda is long, and I just appreciate you took some time for us.
No problem. Thank you, Representative Scalzi, and I will renew the motion that House File 1991, as amended, be recommended to pass, and pass to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it goes to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Next, we have House File 2175, Representative Horstman. And I will move House File 2175 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. Welcome, Representative Horstman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This will feel a little bit like Groundhog Day for you. Last time I was here, I had a bill, House File 877, and what it did is directed the PCA to apply for some federal economic stimulus funds to get auxiliary power units for truckers to establish a grant or a loan program so that we could help truckers reduce their diesel emissions. Since that time, I've learned a few things about the Federal Economic Stimulus Program. There are four different programs under which the PCA can get funding. One of them, the PCA has already applied for and is guaranteed to receive $1.7 million. There's three other that are competitive grant programs. There's one called the National Program, the Emerging Technologies Program, and the Smart Way Finance. Now, we don't know yet. We're still waiting for the information. And, in fact, I got an email from the EPA at 5 o'clock while I was waiting to have my bill heard with more details on one of these three programs. The bill that I have in front of you today, House File 2175, would direct the PCA to apply another competitive grant application to try to get some money for Metro Transit buses, which one of the things that they're already doing is switching to hybrid buses to reduce emissions in highly impacted areas, and they're also doing some retrofits to the transmissions of the buses. And so this is very much along the lines of House File 877. And what I had passed out to you, Mr. Chair, is the A1 amendment, and I couldn't find anybody to draft it. You know, things keep changing so fast here. But the thing that the A1 amendment makes clear is there's no match required. These programs are all fully funding the projects, and there's no match required.
Okay. And I will move the A1 amendment to get it some shape and form that the author would like. Although... Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, on the A1 amendment, I delete lines 1.1 through 1.5 and insert delete everything after the enacting clause and insert.
Okay. And Representative Horton, would you like to incorporate that into your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Okay. And yes, could you repeat that, Ms. Taylor?
Sure. Delete lines 1.1 through 1.5 on the A1 amendment and insert. Delete everything after the enacting clause and insert.
Okay. Thank you. And I will then move the A1 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. And Representative Horton.
Mr. Chair, that's about it. I just think that it's important for us to reduce the diesel emissions in our area if we can. And if there's federal money out there to be got and other states are submitting applications, I would like us to be in the pool. I suspect we may be amending the bill later on when we figure out which of the three competitive grant programs we most appropriately fit under for Metro Transit buses, and I could also potentially see an amendment in Environment Finance to include the St. Cloud Transit Authority or the Rochester Transit Authority because they have significant efforts underway, similar to the Metro Transit efforts. And I would just note that the PCA would love if I would change the word must to may apply for the money. But at this point, I'm going to leave it as must, and we'll just keep talking about that.
Okay. Any questions for Representative Horton? Okay, seeing none, I will renew the motion that House File 2175 be recommended to pass and that House File 2175 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent to go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Thank you. Sure. And Representative Saylor, would you be ready to, we can move you up, we're moving you up the line just a little bit here. So Representative Kelly had to be on another committee at this time. You may be needed at another committee, Representative Kelly, so we'll Representative Kelly. And I will move House File 1393 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it goes to Environment Finance. So, welcome to the committee, Representative Kelly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I certainly appreciate your courtesy in hearing this bill. Mr. Chair and Committee, this is a really local issue that we've been working on for several years, and we do believe we're close, but we do need some assistance. This involves a landfill that stopped accepting waste back in 1998, and we're working to get the property into the closed landfill program. So the situation is somewhat unique, so I've got three individuals here with me that will give us a little more detail. I've got Goody County Commissioner Ted Seifert and County Engineer Greg Isaacson.
Okay. Thanks. And if you'd like to speak to the bill, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, thanks for the opportunity and the rest of the committee members to give some testimony on this. My name is Ted Seifert. I'm a Red Wing resident and have been a county commissioner for several years. This legislation is as a result of a memorandum of understanding that was mandated by the PCA. We are all supportive of the rule of law, but as we get into the nitty-gritty sometimes, it's a little bit gray, and this bill should help to clarify that. This bill is very specific language in response to the MPCA staff concerns. In fact, the MPCA staff helped draft the bill. If the bill does not go forward, it's going to cause Goodhue County and the City of Red Wing to have to close a landfill, an ash landfill that is not full, acquire land, and reestablish another landfill at taxpayer expense. And this seems like a waste of tax dollars. It also isn't very supportive of the governor's hierarchy for solid waste, nor does it support the waste energy incinerator that the City of Red Wing operates. So with that, I would answer any questions, or that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Seifert. If you'd like to state your name for the record.
Yes, sir. My name is Greg Isaacson. I'm also from Red Wing. I'm the Public Works Director, County Engineer from Goodhue County. This bill that we're talking about here today is somewhat of a unique situation. In this case, the City of Red Wing, not the county, owns and operates a waste-to-energy combustor facility. The ash from the city's facility is deposited within a still-open active ash cell of the county's closed municipal landfill on Bench Street in Red Wing. The landfill was originally operated by the City of Red Wing from 76 to 1990 when the county took over the landfill. The county then operated this landfill for a short 7 years before it closed and stopped accepting municipal solid waste, closed and capped those cells with that waste in it. But the fact that the city of Red Wing continues to deposit ash into the active ash cell, this landfill does not meet the PCA's current requirements and criteria for entering into the closed landfill program. The county at this point is spending anywhere between $37,000 and $76,000 a year to monitor this closed landfill. Now, back in 2006, the county, as a recurring event, updated the solid waste plan. It was submitted to the PCA, who 9 months after submittal actually did approve it. But evidently, some of the staff at the PCA thought that the county's plan should have stronger support for steering waste, or called fuel, to Red Wing's incinerator. And before they approved our plan, the PCA strong-armed the county to enter into this memorandum of understanding, an MOU, if you will, for exchange for a very short 5-year approval instead of a typical 10-year approval of our solid waste plan. This unique situation with the PCA requires the county to enter into an MOU to support another entity's facility as part of receiving approval of our solid waste plan. This MOU was signed by the City of Red Wing's Council President, Chairman of the County Board, and the Commissioner of the PCA. Now, once the objectives behind the task listed in the Memorandum of Understanding are completed, we agree that the city and the county should have a very good solid waste program that strongly supports the governor's goals for reducing greenhouse gases, it promotes alternative energy sources, and it supports the state's long-standing hierarchy of solid waste disposal. Now, one of those tasks listed out in that Memorandum of Understanding specifically says under Task 5, that we are going to work to transfer the ownership of the Bench Street landfill to the MPCA. After numerous meetings, which started in October of 2007, PCA County and City staff, working to fulfill the tasks in this MOU, created this unique solution that has become House File 1393. This is a unique solution that requires thinking outside the box. The solution came after many hours of brainstorming a solution to meet the intent of this Task 5 of the MOU, and the proposal would allow the county's landfill to be accepted into the PCA's closed landfill program while the city of Red Wing is still using one of the cells to landfill the ash that's coming from the combusting unit that the PCA is so concerned with supporting. The solution is unique because it does allow an active cell in a closed landfill. This is a scenario which most likely does not meet the PCA's current definition of a closed landfill, and that's one reason why we're here, looking for legislative action. The language of House File 1393 creates a solution to a unique problem that exists for the county, and once this problem is solved, it allows the county to continue to work to meet all the objectives listed out in the Memorandum of Understanding. Now, we understand that some of the staff at the PCA are concerned that if this language is allowed, that there may be other cities and other counties out there that may want to transfer their landfills to the PCA's closed landfill program. But if there are other cities or counties that have a waste energy facility, put a material recovery facility in the front of it, can reduce their ash to less than 10% of the incoming waste, then we think those other facilities that also help meet the state's solid waste disposal goals. This bill also specifies that the commissioner would assume the financial responsibility for what's known as post-closure and contingency actions. The county is requesting this because, as I mentioned earlier, the county only operated this facility for 7 years. Most landfills are operated by one entity for a long period of time, giving that operator an opportunity to generate sufficient post-closure funds to be turned over to the state. The tipping fees generated by the county during the short time frame was not enough to even close the landfill. The county had to go out and secure a bond for over $1.8 million just to close the landfill. This bond obligation hangs over the county until the year 2013. We believe this is a unique situation, and this is a unique solution to that situation, and we're asking your support to be part of our solution. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Isaacson. Any questions for the testifiers or Representative Lagunius?
Thank
when the closed landfill program was done, it was told everybody else that no other landfills were going to enter into it, and that other landfills that remained open had to have assurance funds to make sure there was enough money set aside to properly close the landfill. What kind of assurance fund do you all have?
Mr. Isaacson.
Chairman and representative, at this time the county carries a line of credit for those funds. It costs the county, I believe it's $15,000 going up to $30,000 a year to carry that line of credit for those funds.
Representative Genius.
My question was, how much is there to pay for your closure and post-closure care?
Mr. Isaacson.
The letter of credit that we're carrying, we carry a letter of credit for $1.5 million for potential post-closure costs or contingencies. But there is no money actually sitting in an account in the county for that contingency cost.
Okay. Representative Borgenius.
Do you know how much it would cost to do the closure and post-closure of this landfill?
Mr. Isaacson.
The landfill, the municipal cells of the landfill are closed. The ash portion of it, the city is collecting some money for the closure of it. And I don't have the details of where the city is in closing their active land cell portion of it. Part of the agreement with the city was that since it is a county landfill, but they're still using that part of it, they'll be responsible for closing that ash cell.
Representative Genius.
Well, members, the reason I bring that up is because if you look at the landfill program, it's in deficit right now, and we don't have the money to meet the obligations of the landfills that are in. Now, we will meet those obligations, but it was, I thought, made very clear to folks when that landfill program came into being that there weren't going to be any others put in it, and that's why folks had to carry their own assurance fund, and that PCA was supposed to help people set up the fund to make sure it was big enough to do the closure and post-closure so we wouldn't have the kind of problem that we had with the old landfill. So it was supposed to be that kind of the, okay, it was a bad dog, and that bad dog was locked up in the barn. And it was supposed to be an example to everybody else to do the right thing. And I so the question about whether you have enough money is troubling to me, that you should have enough money, and if you don't, then why isn't PCA requiring you to have enough money? I mean, that's a huge issue.
Okay. And Representative Gardner, that's a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to express some similar thoughts as Representative Eugenius, but I'll move on to something else. So what's the expected lifespan of the ash cell? At what point will the entire facility be capped?
Mr. Isaacson.
Chairman and Representative, at the rate the city is continuing to put ash into it, and the fact that they're building the material recovery facility, which will reduce the amount of ash going into it, it will probably, at its current rate, be active for over 20 years.
Representative Gardner.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to suggest, too, if this bill keeps moving, I would hope you provide to the Environmental Finance Committee a copy of that memorandum of understanding so we can take a look at some of the details. But I too am concerned about the backlog that CCA has right now. They're just trying to finish up a couple of landfill cleanup projects. One's up in the Duluth area. We've got the Washington County landfill, which is going to be in the tens of millions of dollars, and then the Freeway landfill in the Burnsville area hasn't even entered in the CLT, and that's been the big metro ticking time bomb we're all concerned about, and there's a time sensitivity with that one because where the water is going to go as it's leaking out of it is going to change here with the closure of another facility right next door. So even if you were get eligibility, I think you'd be on the list quite a while. And the PCA even needs some more bonding authority to be able to fulfill the obligations for those other facilities that I just mentioned. But I have the same concerns on the financial assurance funds that were supposed to be set up.
Any other questions? Okay, we do have a couple of... Representative McNamara, did you want to have a question?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to take over for Representative Kelly while he runs, and I think I have a couple questions, and I believe what's important is we could get MPCA down here, because sure. There's been some development. So sure. If I could fill in for Representative Kelly, he's got to work to another committee. We'll keep going with it. Okay. Mr. Chair, my question was going to be to ask if MPCA could come down along the lines of Representative Wagenia and Representative Gardner's questions. There's been some development in the possibility of the cell. There's a XL is also have a facility where they're disposing ash, and it's a substantially larger facility that Commissioner Seifert had mentioned that maybe the possibility and the MPCA had brought it up about the possibility of working with XL on how they might be able to look at this project a little differently, and it was actually the MPCA's idea. So I think, Mr. Chair, if we could hear from MPCA, it might give us all some good information.
Sure. And Ms. Thorvig, welcome back.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Lisa Thorvig, Municipal Division Manager. With me is Jeff Lewis, manager of our closed landfill program. We had asked to testify, so I have some testimony, but if you would like us to answer Representative McNamara's question, Mr. Lewis could do that right off the bat.
Okay, yes, Mr. Lewis, if you could answer the question.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara.
And if you could also state your name for the tape.
I'm sorry, my name is Jeff Lewis, and I manage the closed landfill program at the MPCA. We have been meeting with Goodhue County and the City of Red Wing over a fairly long period of time, both with our closed landfill program as well as the staff in Lisa's division who work on our open landfills to try and resolve a number of issues. This site has probably generated enough controversy within our agency to last for a while. We sent a letter to the county and the city that laid out a couple of different options. This site actually has three different cells on it. It has a old cell that contained the regular mixed municipal waste that was closed a number of years ago and a cap put on it. It has a demo cell that's currently open, and it has an ash cell. The ash cell is lined and is currently taking the ash from the MSW garbage burner there in Red Wing. Those three cells are right on top of each other and basically do not provide any opportunity to try and isolate them or monitor them separately. So what we told the city and the county is that if they wanted any chance of coming into the closed landfill program, they had to close the whole site because there was no way you could try and monitor individually what was going on at that site and try and establish who was going to do what when problems developed. One of the options we did suggest to them is that they try and work with Xcel Energy. Xcel operates a landfill of their own that's on property adjoining this site. And basically we tried to encourage them to work with Xcel to take Xcel's ash into this cell if they wanted to close it in a quicker fashion. Xcel generates about 10 times as much ash as the City of Red Wing facility. But unless the facility was completely closed, there was no way that we would even try and entertain it coming into the closed landfill program. I guess maybe to address a couple of issues, other issues, Representative Wagenius brought up a point that We have had a number of discussions with her committee. The closed landfill program is currently about $79 million short in funding for the next five-year period. And for us to try and take on any other sites, especially sites that don't have money to pay for the work that's needed, would be very problematic for us. And so we've tried to have discussions with them about, unless they came into the program with money, there really wasn't much we could do there either. It would not be fair to the other counties and municipal landfills that came in turned over their financial assurance to us. There were about 25 facilities that did that when they came into the program, turning over somewhere over $15 million to us to help with the cleanup work. So there's a number of problems with this particular site. The agreement that was referenced in the earlier testimony was an MOU that was signed between the entities, the MPCA, the county, and the city. That MOU basically said we would try and work with them to get the facility to qualify for the closed landfill program. It did not say that we were going to take the site, and there certainly has been a lot of discussion since then that to try and work on some of these issues that are still outstanding with us.
Okay. Thank you. And Representative Gardner has a question.
Mr. Lewis, are there monitoring wells for this closed cell, CMS, the municipal solid waste cell? So, I mean, I guess I'm questioning is, compared to the other sites that you have in the queue now, how does this one rate in terms of imminent threat to public health?
Mr. Lewis. Mr. Chair and Representative Gardner, there is a monitoring system. In fact, it's a pretty extensive monitoring system on this facility. The problem with it is that you can't really, because of the cells being more or less intermingled, you can't distinguish where any of the contaminants are coming from. Typically with a site like this that has different cells, we sometimes be able to look at the contaminants and be able to tell what type of what cell they're coming from, but on this particular site there wasn't really good management of what waste went where. There was ash that was placed in the garbage cell, there was ash that was placed in the demo cell, and we were never able to distinguish in our monitoring system where the contaminants are coming from. There are low-level contaminants that are coming off of that landfill at the present time. Nothing that's exceeding intervention limits, and as such, as far as additional cleanup work that would be needed, it wouldn't be a high priority for us at this time. But there are some low-level contaminants coming off that site.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Lewis. Any other questions for Mr. Lewis or Representative Wagenius?
If memory serves, that closed landfill program was for mixed municipal solid waste. And now we're talking about something that has ash in it. It's a different... have you all thought about... I mean, this is very different to have the state take over ash landfills. Am I right about that?
Mr. Lewis.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wagenius, we do have a couple of sites in our program that had ash cells that only operated for short periods of time, and so we do have a couple of ash cells within the program. But I think more importantly was the point that you raised earlier about when the closed landfill program was established in 1994, the intent of it at that time was to take facilities that didn't have the financial insurance or the capabilities of taking care of the contaminants that were there. Any facility that was left open after 94, the intent of the regulations that were in place were for them to generate enough money to take care of future problems that occurred there.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? And Representative McNamara.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could ask Mr. Lewis, I'm trying to understand this development of the ability to potentially use XL to dump into the cell that would fill the cell up sooner. If and when the cell did get filled up, would it then be eligible for the closed landfill? And then along that line, would XL be generating some fees if they were dumping in the cell that would help meet the requirements of their, or the, that would help meet the cost, future cost?
Mr. Lewis.
Mr. Chair and Representative McNamara, what we were trying to encourage was, you know, part of the solution to the overall issue here. It wasn't going to address all of the issues with this site, but part of the issue that the county was facing was, you know, how do they justify closing the facility when it hasn't reached its permitted life? And to try and solve that, what we tried to do was give them the option of trying to work something out with XL. We thought that was an option that was viable for generating enough waste to fill the facility up so that, you know, it's basically using its useful life. You know, adding sites to the closed landfill program has always been kind of problematic. There was the addition of six facilities after the original law was passed, but those were completed by the year 2000, and there haven't been any additional sites that have been added. We don't have the ability to accept additional sites into the program unless it is done legislatively. So it's, you know, basically, we're trying to work on the 112 that we're assigned to. You know, and if we got those 112 taken care of, maybe the legislature would see to it to expand the program and cover other sites. But, you know, we still have a fair backlog of work to do on the 112 we have in the program.
Ms. Thorvig.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, so we have two concerns with the bill. The first one is that the landfill that the subject of the bill is not closed, and so we feel like it needs to be closed, and there have to be agreements that would allow us to take over the site. But even if it was closed, then we still have the issue of the exemption this provides for the financial assurance, and so it would come in with no money. It would be on, you know, the backs of the taxpayers to pick up the cost of this landfill. We have brought in, as Jeff said, about 25 landfills that came in after the 1994 date. They've come in with the financial assurance of about $15 million. So if you gave an exemption to this facility, the others might come back and ask for their money back as well, since they brought money in. And why it affects me is that I actually have a mandate from the legislature that I was given last session to actually revise our financial assurance rules for open landfills, to tighten them down, to make sure that these landfills actually do have money to close so that taxpayers don't have to pay for it. So this is really contrary to the legislation that was passed last year that's asking us to upgrade the financial assurance requirements. And just to let you know, letters of credit without backing by actual money reserves won't be probably be allowed in the new rule, because that hasn't worked.
Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things. I had discussed with President Kelly because he thought he might have to leave to go to the other committee. So he was wondering about the possibility. You had made the motion to move it to finance with the idea that it would go to Representative Wagenius' committee. Based on the discussion and the thought about dealing with XL and the thought, I'm wondering if the committee would be willing to keep it in its jurisdiction and lay it over with the idea that the county, Representative Kelly, the MPCA, and XL has a real interest in the ash disposal, because we have a serious issue with them adjoining my district with Representative Bunn. So I think bringing XL to the table down in Red Wing would be a good idea, and look at what the possibilities are. And Representative Wagenius has raised a number of good questions about, we want to be careful as we move forward
in how we do this and that we have financial wherewithal to where we're going. So that's what Representative Kelly's interests were, Mr. Chair.
Sure. And I am willing to lay it over. Are there any questions before I do so or any other comments? Representative Gardner.
I was just going to end by saying that as we think about 2010 with bonding requests, that I think having bonding authority for you to meet your deficit to clean up some of the sites you've got in your queue would be helpful. Is that correct? Just to let my friends here know.
Mr. Lewis? Representative Orgenius.
I don't think we have the bonding capacity to clean up all these sites. That the only potential we have, the original bonding for this was $90 million, and the rest was to come from the solid waste fee. And it was to come from the solid waste fee, mainly of folks who were commercial, because those were the ones that benefited from this program. And they benefited hugely because there were no, the state was taking them over and the responsible parties didn't have to have lawsuits and settle out who paid. So it seems to me that even to meet our past obligation, we're going to have to look at those fees. And that stays a huge issue. So to think of somebody else coming in without assurance when they should have been saving aside the money, and the notice has been out there, it's very troubling.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, I will lay the bill over. So, thank you. Next, that's a junkie.
Which one you want?
The 1958 we have up first.
Okay.
So, Representative Junkie moves House File 1958. He recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. And I understand you have an amendment.
I do, and I have an amendment, or I have an additional verbal amendment to the amendment. I don't know if you want to move the amendment first and the verbal, or if you want to incorporate the verbal into your motion to move the amendment.
Why don't we incorporate?
All right, here's what you want to incorporate, Mr. Chair. On page 2, line 15, after the word results, and make recommendations on water improvements. The study results and make recommendations on water improvement to all state agencies. That's how that line will read then.
Okay.
And if you incorporate that into your amendment and then
sure.
Put the amendment on, I think we're in the shape we need it.
Okay, again, line 2.15, after results, insert and make recommendations in water improvement. And yes, if you want to incorporate that.
Water improvement, yeah.
Oh.
No, I can do it. I'm
yeah.
On this committee.
Right.
I get confused. I'm so late. We finished Green Acres tonight. And we were, so that's all done. And then I was down doing liquor bills. And, all right.
So,
yeah, I would move. I'll incorporate that into my amendment and move the amendment to get it in the shape I want.
Okay. Representative Junkie moves the A09-0277 amendment to get it in the shape and form that he would like. As incorporated, all those who are in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed. Motion prevails. Bill is amended. And Representative.
And Mr. Chair, I brought Lisa Frenette here, and I'm going to ask her to do the testimony on the bill.
Ms. Frenette, welcome to the committee.
And there's many others that would want to testify, but a lot of them were around for Green Acres, and it looks like they all abandoned it. So I don't know where they went.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I've been abandoned before, so hopefully I can get everything out. Thank you very much. I appreciate the chance to get up and speak with you about this. This bill, what it does is it may be inappropriately worded, and I'm not sure, so if somebody wants to correct me, please let me know. I was told that it's not the Clean Water Legacy Council, but that's what we have in the bill, so I'll go from there to appoint a technical advisory group. And what we'd like the technical advisory group to do is consider scientific data that's currently available on TMDL's stormwater and wetland loss with relationship to agency rulemaking. We would like to ask the advisory committee to identify, this is what the bill does here, to identify current rules and what the goals of the rules are, and more importantly, how have these regulatory rules been achieved, and have they been achieved to their fullest extent? We'd also like to identify if a watershed-based approach is better, or if a state agency-administered approach to programs and rules is the best possible way to approach the regulatory rulemaking process. We'd also like to assess why some programs are best left at local levels and some of them are administered at the state level, and then identify the real and perceived barriers of the reduction or the elimination of programs and rules between the state and federal regulations, and ask to interpret, kind of put it all together, how the agencies are working together to implement clear and cohesive rulemaking that can be understood by all. And this comes from conversations with several groups of people on all the rulemaking processes that are out right now. And you should have in your packet a current agency rulemaking projects on all the water rules right now. And there's 15 total. There's 10 in the PCA, 2 in the Board of Water and Soil Resources, 2 with Department of Natural Resources, and 1 with the Environmental Quality Board. And some of these rulemaking processes are overlapping each other. We're concerned about whether the agencies are coordinating with each other, whether or not they're not coordinating with each other. And I had the privilege to read a National Academy of Sciences study back about a month ago that talked about the fact that states are passing a lot of haphazard laws and regulations on water quality that aren't coordinated and have no scientific data. And it really made me start to think that maybe something Minnesota could do was to be the impetus for looking at how we can coordinate all these rules and make them one so that they're cohesive. With your long night, I'll stop there.
Thank you, Ms. Finesse. And Representative Lagenius.
Thank you. This is just curious to me, and here's my curiosity. The Clean Water Legacy Council is a group of folks appointed by the governor, and you're talking about the governor's agencies. If you wanted something like this done, the governor could be doing this right this minute. It doesn't need to be legislation, because you're asking one group of governor's folks to talk to another group of governor's folks. Why don't you talk to the governor?
That's a very, Mr. Chair, Representative Virginia, that's a very fair question. However, our thought behind this is that the governor probably should have already been doing something like this with the Clean Water Legacy Council, and it hasn't been done. And we're looking at making sure perhaps it starts to move.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? So, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Junkie, I'm concerned about mission creep. Here with the Clean Water Legacy Council, and it seems to me it might be better to have direct appointees or elected officials rather than going through, you know, if you had the commissioner administration who has to work with all the agencies do that, I would be more supportive than having, then there'd be a direct line of accountability to the governor. Or I'm just wondering what your thoughts are, because it's curious that you're getting some support.
And Mr. Chair, I'm not going to get hung up on which group does. I'm happy to do commissioner administration. That sounds like a good suggestion. Mm-hmm. What I'm more concerned about is getting this going so we can look at it. I mean, as you see, looking at this list and being around here for the last 13 years plus, I do think it's time to review some of this and understand the way we're going about it. So I think it'd be helpful for all of us to get this done. How you go, which group? I don't care. If you want a minute, Representative Hansen, go ahead.
Hey, Representative Hansen.
You're the policy committee. So I will move on line 1.4 to amend the Clean Water Legacy Council and strike that and insert commissioner of administration.
Okay. Representative Hansen moves that on line 1.4, strike Clean Water Legacy Council and insert Commissioner of Administration. Any discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So any further discussion to the bill as amended?
Mr. Chair, I have no more comments other than just to point out the other handout in your packet from Minnesota Association of Townships, who also thinks this is probably very consistent with the way they're thinking, too, and what they'd like to see done.
Okay. And Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Dunkey, is there a fiscal cost? I assume we'd have people working on this, and there's a technical advisory group.
Well, the group serves without compensation on 1.12, and the Commissioner Administration does the appointing, so if they are, they're minimal, but whatever you want to do with it, I guess, wherever you want it to go, I have no problem with it.
And the motion was to send it to finance.
Oh, okay. Well, then we'll make sure we can get a fiscal note and make sure that we got it covered.
Sure. Any other questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, Representative Junkie renews his motion that House File 1958 be recommended to pass and referred as amended. Be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention to go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. And Representative Junkie, your second bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House File 1972. Be recommended to pass, and I don't know if Representative Guineas wants this for her omnibus bill or it's changing a fee amount. I think it's going to be minimal on up or down. I don't even know if they can calculate it at this point, but I'm happy to throw it in your omnibus bill. I always like to travel an omnibus bill myself. So you'll take it. All right.
We'll move that, Representative Junkie moves that House File for 1972 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance. And
then I have Representative Hackbart's going to offer the DE2 amendment, which is a friendly amendment, but I'll let him offer it and explain it.
Okay, Representative Hackbart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will move the DE2 amendment, the Green All Amendment. This is an agreement that we've come to, Representative Junkie and I, and we've been working with the Department of Natural Resources on this issue. And the bill that Representative Junkie brought forward was to address an issue with commercial stables and people that are renting horses and needing to buy a trail path to go out on the trail. So this gets at the issue of the folks that are coming to these commercial operations not having a path. This is going to allow the stables or the people renting the horses to obtain passes for their horses, so the individuals that are coming there don't have to run out, buy passes, and come back and then go out on the trail. I believe that this is actually going to bring more money to the dedicated account that's going to help with maintaining horse trails. So I'm glad Representative Junkie brought the bill. I think it's a good bill, and we've worked out the differences. And Mr. Chairman, we do have some oral changes that need to be made that I'd like to incorporate into the amendment before we vote on it, and Council has those changes that she'd like to read them.
Okay, Ms. Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members, the first amendment would be on page 1, line 17, after additional. Insert or individual commercial annual horse trail.
Okay, could you repeat that one more
sure.
time?
The after additional, insert or individual commercial annual horse trail. And then also on page 1, line 20, delete or and insert a comma. And then after saddle, comma, insert or person, comma.
Okay. Again, to repeat, line 1.17, after additional, insert or individual commercial annual horse trail. And line 1.20, strike or, and insert a comma, and after saddle, insert or person. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair.
And then it's adopted. Yes, Representative.
Yeah, two things. That's a very good addition. What that does is allows you either to affix a license to the tack or hold it on the person. And it depends on how the horse owner, if they have the same tack on, the same horse all year, might be easier to affix it there. But if they change saddles and tack and other things, they could be literally on the person, which is what we do with the other standard passes.
So that was a good change. The other change allows, if you only have four horses in your stable, you can then go out and buy the individual at $20 each, so you don't pay the $200, you can pay the $80. So we're not penalizing someone for having less horses in their stable, but we're certainly putting a cap on for the larger stables that are utilizing number of riders and horses throughout the days. And we have some of these out in my area by Sibley State Park. There's some stables that rent to park people when they're there with their families, and you can imagine how many different riders are on different horses during the day, and they get these passes. One other, so I think this is a very good change, and like Representative Hackbar said, it's going to encourage people to buy these passes, perhaps, and maybe even enhance the dollars in there in the long run. But it should save money on those larger operations that, you know, are being penalized, I think, because we were licensing the individual rather than the horse or the operation. Also, I'd like to add another amendment now to the bill. I'd like an effective date, and staff could do this at the end. This will be effective January 1st, 2010, so we don't, number one, I'm sure they got to take care of the machining and the programming of this, but we've probably technically already started our season this year, and to make a change midstream when this will become effective would be difficult. So if we make it effective beginning January 1st, 2010, then we're in good shape there. Oh, here comes Mr. Meyer. Now, he told me to do it. Now he's going to tell me something's wrong with that.
That's when Dale has something to say.
No, I just think that Mr. Meyer came forward. It should be March 1st, as I recall, because that's when is it?
Mr. Meyer, Representative Dale. Our new system will be implemented and up and running March 1st, but people will want to be buying these licenses January 1st of next year. So we're going to have to make sure that we're accommodating the license season. So that's why this date is January 1st rather than March 1st, 2010.
And if Mr. Myers would tell you all he's against the bill while he's up here, I know it'll pass easier. So
I'm just teasing. I'm teasing. It didn't work last time.
So, Representative Hackbarth, would you want to just incorporate that in as well?
No, we've already adopted the amendment, so it's my amendment now to the bill.
I thought we just
okay. He incorporated the last ones, and then we voted on the amendment, sure. And now I'll amend the bill.
Okay. Again, the amendment, is that after line 2.4?
Yeah, wherever it says, use
okay.
It again.
Instead of January 1st, 2010.
Effective January
1st. Effective
yeah.
January 1st, 2010. Okay, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails.
That's the bill, and I do, in all sincerity, want to thank the Department of Natural Resources for working with me on this. They recognize it as a glitch, too, in the law, and they should take care of it, we hope, moving forward.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Seeing none, I will represent Junkie renews his motion. I'm not sure I got the right bill again here. That was House File 1972, as amended. He recommended to pass the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair and members.
Bill is passed. Next, Representative Wardenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am bringing two bills to you. One that is very technical, and one is that definitely big picture policy. Should we start with 1673?
Yes.
I would like to move House File 1673 and have it recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance with the final destination being Environment Finance.
Representative Wardenius moves House File 1673 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. Representative Wardenius.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have had a number of conversations in this committee about what happens to easements once they've been purchased, or what happens to lands once they've been purchased in Minnesota. Do we have a plan for long-term management? And that is what this bill is about. And the bill I introduced dealt with easements only. The amendment that I have am bringing to you is a delete all, but it only changes one thing. It was just easier to see as a delete all. And instead of just doing easements, we're also talking about lands purchased in fee title. So it is conceptually everything is the same, and that is the addition. So I would like, if you would adopt DE1, and I would move that amendment.
Okay. Representative Virginius moves the adoption of the DE1 amendment. Get it in the shape and form she would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Virginia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. We have purchased in this state many parcels of land, and we don't have the money to manage those parcels of land. We've purchased many easements. And DNR is now trying to figure out exactly how many easements it has, and looking at where the easements are, what they're supposed to be doing, so we can go check up on them. And the reason we need to do that is because Minnesotans spent good money to get a benefit, and we've got to make sure that that benefit is there for them. So what this does is say, starting now, this is not backtracking, this is starting now, or starting this summer, that under four circumstances, if a holder of a conservation easement executed on or after July 1st, 2009, that is purchased in whole or part with state funds shall contribute 5% of the appraised value of the land to a long-term land management account. And that land, and so there's, that's one instance, but there's three others. A holder of a conservation easement that transfers it to the state, and in C on line 122, the owner of land acquired in fee title purchased in whole or part with state funds. And then if you, and D, the owner of land acquired in fee title purchased in whole or part with state funds gives it to the state or transfers it to the state. So it's a 5% that goes into a fund. And it's 5% of the appraised value goes into the fund, and that fund is held on page 3 at the top. It says it can only be spent on the management, monitoring, and enforcement of easements and the management of land. And these funds must be appropriated by law and shall not be appropriated until July 1, 2017. There is an exception, and it's a large exception, and the exception starts in 2.17, and it's an exemption for folks who hold easements, this is part, you know, with purchase in whole or part with state money, that have a history of providing long-term management, have the ability to do that, or have the potential to set aside those funds so they can do it themselves. So it's the same for an easement and a fee title. It shows the 5% of the appraised value for ease, for one, and secondly, because we do not have a history of knowing exactly what this cost is going to be. I wish we did what this cost is going to be. I wish we did, but we don't have that history. Some folks have suggested that we should lower it to 2 or 3 or 4%. Some folks have suggested that we go through a major rulemaking and do it based on the type of land. I don't think we have the experience to go through a rulemaking to do that kind of thing because we don't know the long term. So while I am believe that 5% is the right number, I think that that is certainly open for a lot of discussion. But the concept, the policy of whether we should set aside some money for long term management is the one that I bring to you.
Representative Junkie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Genius. This is a very good bill. I would say I signed on to it along with David's bill and Solberg, so we think it's all good. But One of the things that Bill and I and others wanted to do in this committee, but again, it's not here yet, but we hope it'll be ready for your finance committee, is amend this to go even further. And then frankly, a couple, maybe 6 or 7 weeks ago, I asked for the language upstairs, and it's still not down. So we're AJ. I think it's AJ's fault. That's a little inside joke. I asked him to do it. Yeah. Anyway, we're waiting for that. Hopefully, it'll be down in time for your finance hearings. But what we'd like to do, too, in my area, I was alerted to this by the township. The township in the southern part of my county came to me and said, you should really be doing what the Fish and Wildlife are doing. I said, what's that? They said, well, they just purchased some easements and some land in our township. And what they did is not only purchased the land, but then they gave them a deposit. And they said, this is yours. I don't know what it was, 20% or 25 or 15% on top of the sale price, just like you're talking about. You can put it away in a fund, and this will pay your PILT, your payment in lieu of taxes, forever, based on the current tax values and appraisal at time of sale, assessed value. And or you have the option as township or county to spend it, but then don't come to us asking for PILT. And that's how the federal government is handling it now. I thought that was an excellent way to handle that, because we are responsible for PILT into the future as taxpayers. If we do it up front, then everyone knows it's paid for. We're not arguing at time of budget shortfalls. Right now, I think there's a $5 million cut asked for in the PILT, and that's going to hurt all of us with public lands out there. So I think this is a very good amendment, and I hope we can add to it as we go on to look at establishing those accounts for PILT also on purchases. Because, again, and we're having a lot of talk this year about all these groups, you're right, that are purchasing land. I'm not against the Lessard Council or necessarily LCCMR or the legislature, all these people buying land. But you're right, we have to pay for it at some point in time. It adds cost. So the only technical thing I'd ask research staff here to look at, I'm not going to make a change now because I don't know exactly where it would fit. You contribute 5% of appraised value within 30 days of the purchase agreement. You might, two things. Number one, there should be an appraised value if an appraisal was done. I don't think an appraisal is required on all DNR land. There's a dollar kicker on that. So either you want to say appraised value or assessed value. And the assessed value obviously is available from the assessor at time of sale on all pieces. And then again, I don't know how, it's usually lower than the appraised value, however, so it'd be less money in your fund. But if there isn't an appraisal, how do you handle it, number one? And then you want to make sure that the assessed or appraised value is at time of sale, so they're not bringing in an old appraisal or some other time frame. And those are technical things, but I think you need to adjust those before you get to the floor so you're very clear. Not all these parcels will have an appraisal. They all have an assessed value, and you need to make sure you're on track with that.
Be glad to work on that.
And any other questions or comments? Representative Dill, did you have any?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Junkie just said everything that I had on my mind. And I just see, now, do I take, Madam Chair, do I take that your head nodding is in basic principle agreement with us on that idea? Some idea like that?
Actually, I'm sitting here thinking it's a much better idea than setting it aside in a long-term fund. Now, for the management purposes, I think we have to set it aside in a long-term fund. But for the PILT payment, that actually seems to me to work better than setting it aside in a long-term fund. So I would, because I was thinking that was could become a difficult management issue.
Right.
But doing it that way, you solve your problem right at the get-go.
Well, Mr. Chair.
While
you were talking, it made me think about something else. When we have these funds out there hanging around that we had all the good intentions of having and keeping and maintaining, and then we run into a $5 billion or $6 billion budget deficit, they're just primed to be grabbed. And if we go ahead and give them to the local unit of government, then it wouldn't be sitting around in a fund, which could be raided.
I do have experience with one long-term fund that's sitting out there, but you're right, they can be raided, but there is a long-term management fund for landfills, not the cleanup fund, but after the post-up, 30 years, and it has not been raided.
And I think all of us as grown-ups need to say that some of these things that are meant for long-term management should not be rated under any circumstances. But I actually do like the alternative tilt better than I like the tilt.
Mm-hmm. And Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have the same thoughts as evidently everybody here. I had a couple of questions. Representative Wagenius, my original thoughts were that we need about 10% because I was wondering if the word, for instance, on page 3.2 where you use the word management, would you construe that word management there to include on the, you know, where we have tilt payments on WMAs, would the management include ongoing things like tilt, or what's your thoughts on that word?
Representative Wagenius.
The management was not for ongoing tilt, if I heard you correctly. But this has to be read together with the bill that came before this committee before on the governance of the new funds. And one of the things that we say in there is we adopted the principle that when you had purchased a piece of land or an easement, you also had to have essentially the restoration plan and the money for it in hand. Either that's appropriated altogether or you get the restoration from someplace else. If you do a good restoration, the management should be relatively inexpensive over the long term. If you don't do a good restoration, you've got a lot of weed management. And so this has to be, I think, read together with that other.
Representative McNamara?
If I could follow up, then thank you, Representative Wagenius. I was assuming you didn't mean it to include tilt, but I was wondering, and along the lines of Representative Junkie and Dill, I think we need to talk about that because we should be paying that up front. However we do it, it should be built right into when you're buying it, put enough aside. Mr. Chair, Representative Wagenius, on line 1.16, we talk about the contribute 5% of the appraised value of the land. I'm thinking of a conservation easement. So we buy a conservation easement, this land, maybe it's corn and bean ground now, and it's got a value of, say, $3,000 an acre. Then we put a conservation easement on the land, and we take it out of production. The value of the land in western Minnesota goes down, and the actual land, because it no longer can be farmed, it can be hunting land or recreation land, whatever. What 5% of the value, are you talking 5% of what you paid for the easement, or are you talking the value of the land after the easement's purchased?
Representative Wagenius.
I was talking about the value of the land, and that's one of the conversations we're going to have when we get into finance and make sure that we are using the right number. And one of the reasons that's important is because you said land in western Minnesota, if it goes into conservation, is less valuable if it's come out of corn. Where we have our farm in western Minnesota, it's actually the opposite, that hunting land is more valuable than land for farming now. Beats me, but it's true. If it's nice, I mean, if it's a good piece of it's a good piece of habitat.
Any other questions? Let's see, we have Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Wagenius, I was out of the room, and so maybe you covered this, but I think there's good parts in here in terms of the, particularly when conservation easements are purchased and then transferred to the state, and the contributions and the donation type of question. I'm just wondering about the large enabling piece in the purpose statement, and what happens when we have commingled easements purchased with state and federal dollars. I see all in part, but I'm thinking particularly of a RIM easement that would be purchased, and then there's federal WRP dollars that come in. And I'm assuming that this, the hold lead all applies to those. I'm just wanting to clarify that, and then I'd like to hear from
either Bowser or the feds, if they're here, to see if they can work under this situation.
Okay.
Objection one, that is really done there for tax purposes. That if somebody is going to do a conservation easement, they really have to, it really has to be for conservation purposes, and so this is to state exactly what that purpose is. Your next question is a more difficult one, and I'm not sure how to address that at this point when we have mixed use.
Okay. Hi. Welcome to the committee. Ms. Clocker.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Hansen. Could you please repeat your question?
And Representative Hansen. Mr. Chair and Ms. Clocker, have you had a chance to look at this? So I'm wondering, particularly with RIM, when there is a combination of state dollars and federal dollars, and what the application of this law, this bill, if it became law, how that would work, or if you're able to make it work in those programs. I mean, those are a little different than kind of the straightforward purchase of the easement by one entity, but you have commingled dollars. So I'm just trying to figure out how that would work.
Okay, and if Ms. Clocker, you could state your name for the record, please.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Julie Clocker, Assistant Director of the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and Representative Hansen. I cannot speak to the federal program, but you are absolutely correct that we commingle our money between the WRP program, the federal WRP program, which provides $1.4 for every $1 that Minnesota contributes. My suspicion is that they would probably not be able to use any of their funds for this type of practice, and so if this was to go in place, there might have to be some special bonding language that would allow for this to happen on the Minnesota bonding dollars. The other thing that is, just to make sure we all understand, in the RIM program, we don't use appraised values. We use a formula that's calculated by the University of Minnesota, Dr. Stephen Taft of the Land Economic Institute, and he gives us the average tillable land estimate. And it's a formula, and so there isn't a lot of negotiation with landowners. So it's not an appraisal system, it's a formula system, and it's updated every year, but it's based on the previous 18 months of land activity. So we would need to make sure that that's in there, but as far as actually paying for this, I would imagine that the Minnesota end of that partnership, the RIM WRP partnership, would need to bear the cost of that.
Representative Arginius.
I think maybe what we need to make a distinction here is between permanent easements and easements that are of a duration. One of the, I recall testimony that we had before, that Bowser does look at his easements and does at least drive-by shooting of the easement, which is one of the questions that I think maybe is a good question, Representative Hansen.
Representative Hansen, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Parker, you can work with the author and try to figure this out between the next stops. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Ms. Representative Hansen, absolutely.
Thank you, Ms. Clocker. Any other questions? We do have one other person who would like to testify from the Minnesota Land Trust, Ms. Jane Prohaska. Is that the correct?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jane Prohaska, the Executive Director of the Minnesota Land Trust. We are a private nonprofit conservation organization that holds about 370 easements throughout the state of Minnesota. We do have an easement monitoring management enforcement program, and we do have our own fund, much like that Representative Wagenius has suggested. I want to first say on behalf of the Land Trust that we think this is really cutting-edge concept in the country. We know of no other
state that has really gone this far in thinking about how to set up a long-term, particularly from the conservation easement side, long-term fund to provide resources to take care of the perpetual obligation that comes with the perpetual easement. So we're very excited about the concept and are anxious and looking forward to working on some of the details. The one concern we did have is the way in which the payment to the fund might be calculated, and we do know that there are other methods besides using a percentage of fair market value, either of the land in fee, the assessed value, or the value of the easement. Most land trusts in the country do use a little bit different approach that attempts to estimate the actual cost of what you think monitoring, management, and enforcement costs might be, and then back that out so that you're essentially creating that endowment so it generates enough annual income. And there is some experience around the country, at least on the conservation easement side, and a bit on the fee side as well, on how to think about those calculations. And that would just be a conversation we'd like to continue to have in terms of how such a payment might be calculated. Additionally, we do appreciate the fact that there is an exemption for those who might have established programs, because if there weren't an exemption, there would be difficulties if we raised money, which we typically do. We do also, by the way, work with state funds, environmental and natural resource trust funds, and hopefully some of the new Lafarge Outdoor Heritage Council funds. And some of those funds have gone into our stewardship fund. We have that fiduciary obligation with every easement we take, and we want to make sure we have access to the fund. So if we do want to continue to work on that to make sure if we did have to make a payment to the fund, that we would be assured that our easements would be monitored and enforced from the fund. So I think these are some of the issues that have come up, but we're very interested in finding solutions that meet the long-term needs of the state and those holders of easements as well.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Prohaska. Any questions at all from Ms. Prohaska? Thanks again. Any other questions or comments for Representative Arginius? Okay, seeing none, Representative Arginius renews her motion that House File 1721 be recommended to pass. Excuse me, 1673 be recommended to pass as amended to the Committee on Finance with the intent that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion fails. Bill is passed. And Representative Wiginius, House File 1721.
I'd like to move House File 1771 be recommended, well, perhaps be laid over and included in the omnibus environment bill. And I'll tell you, well, let me just tell you a little bit about it first, because this is such a small technical change to our law. I hate to cut down any more trees to do anything with it. So if I could have Ms. Thornton from the LCCMR just give you a tiny bit of history of why this bill is here.
Okay, and first, Representative Wiginius moves that File 1721 be recommended to, or be laid over for possible inclusion in the Environment Policy Bill. So, please state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Susan Thornton, the director of the LCCMR. House File 1721 is a correction to the statute. When the LCMR was reorganized into the LCCMR in 2006, there were, as a result of an advisory task force, there were recommendations for the length of terms of legislative members and the length of terms of the non-legislative appointed members. There were also provisions in there for term limits. In committee, as that bill was going through, there was an amendment to term limits, and the length of terms for the non-legislative members was inadvertently deleted. We've tried tracking it. We can't figure out whether it's House or Senate, but since I'm in the Senate, we'll say the, or in the House, but we'll say the Senate did it. So essentially, this just reinstates and affirms that the length of terms of service for the non-legislative members are 3 years in duration. And current members have been appointed for staggered terms of 1 to 3 years. So it just fits.
Thank you. Any questions at all? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question would be for Representative Wagenius. Do you have any background or any data or any minutes of the LCCMR that would substantiate that this was just an oversight? Because I did do a little looking, and there is an individual that currently serves on the board that I believe is going to have her term shortened by a year retroactively, if I understand the legislation correctly.
Ms. Burton?
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara. The LCCMR voted on this on January 16th and went through essentially the same explanation that I provided to you. And the commission members, there was discussion that this was really the recommendation of the advisory task force that set up the change in the statute for the LCCMR. And this was discovered when the first member was reappointed. And it was, everybody went looking in the statute for what the length of term was, assuming they would find the 3 years, and there was no statement of the length of term.
Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Thornton, you're saying that everybody thought that's what the intent was. And then did you say the LCCMR did take a vote this past January? So we have that. And I'm just wondering, Representative Wagenius, is it going from here to Environment Finance? Or no, it's going to the floor?
Being laid over. Okay. For possible inclusion.
Okay. Ms. Thornton, if you could present to the chair the documentation or send them an email where we could see that. I just think it'll help it understand, because it's unusual. In other words, what you're saying is we're really not going retroactive. We're fixing what was a mistake. And that's different than going retroactive, because otherwise it looks like we are going back and shortening someone's term from what is stated on the LCCMR's website currently. This person's term is going to be shortened, if I'm not mistaken, from what is stated on the website today, if I am correct in that.
Mr. Chair, Representative McNamara would be happy to pull together those minutes for the review of the Environment Finance Division, as well as I do have a copy of the task force report with the recommendations in it, and as well as the original bill that was introduced in 2006.
And Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is specifically on the exact point of the bill, but as long as it's relating to the LCCMR, I have a question for Representative Genius. Does the LCCMR have an attendance policy?
Representative Genius.
An attendance policy? Well, my policy is to be there every time. and I hope I have been. I may have missed one trip this summer. Now, other than that, I don't know if other than what I can tell you I personally do. Do we have an attendance policy?
Ms. Thornton?
Chair, Representative Hansen, Representative Wagenius, and members, we do keep track of attendance, and I think it's generally understood that attendance is expected at all regular meetings with site visits, because those are often more lengthy in duration and so forth. We keep attendance of those, but that if one members are not believed or to be marked as absent, shall I say?
And Representative Junkie.
Just to that point, I don't know what it is. Sometimes there's statutory reference, and sometimes it's actually in the rules, and it's worth, I don't know what he's getting at, but I serve on the Chicano Latino Affairs Council. And if an appointed member misses more than three consecutive meetings, they can be automatically removed and replaced. So It depends on the group, and it'd probably be in your bylaws or in the originating statutes. There's probably some reference to that. And I think that is an important point. I don't know, again, what Representative Hansen's getting at, but if members are appointed, they should serve. And we have a lot of our boards and stuff where you don't see people for months and months and months, and they have monthly meetings, and you wonder why they ever wanted to be on it.
Representative O'Ginnia.
If I can comment on that, when it comes time to do decision making, if you haven't been on those trips and if you haven't sit and listened to all of those things, I don't see how you can make a decision.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Representative O'Ginnia.
Renew my motion that this be, if that's all right with you, Ms.
That would be fine.
Willis just lay it over for possible approval. I hate to tree cut down for this one.
Sure. So I, Representative Virginius renews her motion that House File 1721 be laid over for possible inclusion in the environment, the omnibus environment policy bill. All those in favor? I guess we'll just lay it over. So, thank you. Let's move on next to House File 2117. Representative Turner.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. With me, I have Mr. Zach Hansen with Ramsey County and Anna Lee Garlitz with the Association of Minnesota Counties.
Okay.
To kind of work through the bill here to kind of get it in the shape we want to be in, there should be an amendment in your packet. It would be the H2117A3 amendment.
Okay. And first, President Turner moves House File 2117.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair.
He recommended the pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. And President Turner also moves the A3 amendment.
It should be a delete all amendment there.
A delete all amendment, the H2117A3 amendment. I think it is in the shape and form that the author would like. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted, and Representative Turner to the bill as amended.
Okay, thank you. So just to give a little bit of background, in 1989, the Minnesota legislature adopted this comprehensive waste reduction and recycling legislation, and it was based on the governor's recommendation of the Select Committee on Recycling and Environment. This set of laws referred to as SCORE is part of the Minnesota Waste Management Act, and it's been administered by the Pollution Control Agency, and it provides counties with a funding source to develop a waste reduction, recycling, and solid waste management program. So in 2008, for example, the SCORE received almost $14 million distribution to all the counties. And so with the House File 217 as currently amended, does it waive the annual reporting requirement for 2010 and establishes a working group of county solid waste officials to re-examine the SCORE reporting requirements and recommended changes to reduce the cost of reporting, which including the possible use of multi-county reporting. For example, in the metropolitan area, six counties kind of work together and they form a swim club. All the met area other than Scott County, you know, is in that one. They would also ensure that these consistent estimation methods are used. Gardner kind of brought up some, you know, information that sometimes the counties that they don't have all the exact data, so they'll estimate it, but it's not standardized what methods they use to estimate the recycling. So we're trying to have more of a consistent estimation going. And so these recommendations are to be made to the legislature by January 15th, 2010. So that's, I guess, about the bill. But the other thing is that you've probably just gotten your packet distributed to you. Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is kind of concerned because we have had this reporting going forward for a while. And so we're trying to get time to be more standardized. So we have a requirement here, which I guess we'll call the amendment in handwriting here. If we could, I don't know what the format, if you have to substitute that, but if we could put that on, amend the bill, that would be helpful.
Sure. Could you repeat the again what you wanted?
Yes, so we want to amend on your bill on section 2. So it would be on the sections 1.5 to 1.7.
Mm-hmm.
On there, and then it should be handwritten on the top, so it'll be here, and I would just take that whole section out and put this in to replace it. Then I could read it, Mr. Chair, like if that'd be helpful for the record and such.
Okay, so you would like to? Oh, one second. Okay, Ms. Taylor will clarify here.
Mr. Chair, members, since we've already adopted the A3 amendment, I just want to clarify when we were doing that, it was referred to as a delete everything amendment, which it is not. And then now, if you just wanted to move the handwritten language, amend that onto the A3 amendment, I think we'll be prepared.
Okay.
I think to make sure I'm hearing you crystal clear is, yeah, that we have a delete all amendment that takes the replace of the House File 2117, and then this would amend the handwritten one, would amend the delete all amendment at the top portion for sections 1.5 to 1.7.
Actually, this is not a delete all amendment, but we will just amend the A3 amendment.
Okay. Yeah.
Replace section 2 to strike section 2. Okay. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah.
And then insert under section 2 the written language at the top of the A3.
Perfect, yes.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Great. Okay. Representative McNamara.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Ms. Taylor's clarification, but I think the problem's arising. We actually, at the same time we were adopting the A3, staff was passing out another amendment that still is labeled A3. So I think if we want to clarify which one of the A3s we adopted, and maybe we want to make sure we adopt the plain one first, and not the one I was looking at with the writing on it.
Maybe what we could do is actually move to reconsider just to make sure that everybody's clear on the vote. And I will move to reconsider the H2117A3 amendment, and that's the one with the writing on it. All those in favor of reconsideration signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Now the H2117A3 amendment is before us. And there is an amendment to that amendment that has been offered by Representative Sterner. And go ahead, Representative Sterner.
Okay, yeah, so thank you, yeah. Mr. Chair. So what this handwritten amendment to our delete all amendment does is that it basically allows a little bit of a carryover for the Pollution Control Agency to express concern. That basically would at least have a 3-day scope for the reporting purposes until we can kind of get everything standardized as far as the reporting of the score reports and as we go forward and such.
Okay, thank you, Representative Sterner. So, Representative Sterner removes the motion to amend the A3 amendment. Excuse me. Maybe what we should do first. I suppose, is that something we could incorporate?
You can incorporate it.
Why don't we just incorporate that into the amendment? And now Representative Sterner removes the motion that the A3 amendment be passed.
Okay.
Although, and it's not a delete all, no.
Quit calling it that.
The A3 amendment. So it's the one with the writing on it. And we have incorporated the written language into section 2. Okay, that's the new section 2. So All those in favor of the A3 amendment as amended, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails, and the bill is amended. And Representative Sterner, any further comments?
Okay. Other than, you know, that I think there are a lot of, it was the governor's office initially this, and the counties are comfortable with it, and now has amended the pollution controls in it, and then Representative Taylor's co-author as well, and we've got good input on it, and we're here to answer questions if you'd like and such, but we'd like to, you know, move the bill or move on to the next committee to finance.
Okay, thank you. And Ms. Garlett, did you have anything you wanted to add? Or just a question.
Members of the committee, my name is Annalie Garlett. I'm with the Association of Minnesota Counties as well as the Solid Waste Administrators Association. A little bit more background, be very brief on this, about this particular, the way that the bill is reading now in front of us. AMC has been working on a redesign initiative to take a look at the way that county government goes about its business, and we've also been trying to identify ways where we can try to cut costs. And I had a lengthy meeting with the Solid Waste Administrators Association, and the topic that came up over and over again was the SCORE report and how it was, since its inception in 1989, there's been a lot of changes to what counties are doing in terms of recycling activities and different solid waste and waste diversion activities. And there's a lot of things that counties are doing that may or may not be captured in the SCORE report. So all the solid waste administrators that I've spoken with really expressed an interest in wanting to sit down and revisit the current method of SCORE reporting and to see if there's a way that we could try to, as it says in here, ways that reduce the resources count on employees to collect the data reported while ensuring estimation methods used to report the data are consistent. I've heard different reports from different people indicating that one county might be making a particular estimate in one direction and another might be using a different method. And in order to compare apples to apples, when we're looking at all of the recycling activities that local governments are doing, it'd be nice if we could all sit back down together and reevaluate how we're doing this so we can all get back on the same page. And I guess that's the end of my testimony for an AMC supports this bill. The Solid Waste Administrators would appreciate support of this bill as well, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Garlett. Any questions at all? And Representative Gardner.
Just some quick comments. Thank you for working hard to change this, Representative Sterner. When this first came out, it was just to drop the reporting and that kind of got my blood up a little bit, so I suggested some stuff, and you and Representative Saylor and some of the stakeholders came up with what I think is good, which is you've got sort of an abbreviated version, and while you're saving some time on that, you sit down and figure out how to actually generate data that's consistent and valid and allows us to make better decisions at the legislature so we actually know what we're collecting. The only thing I was going to mention, and so I urge everybody's support on that, but during the interim, that's when we do a lot of our research to actually get bills in the form we would like, so we don't have to wait till the last minute on a lot of things. And this, report recommendations would be January 15th, 2010, and then we'd get it and mull it over for a month and then go to Ms. Taylor or Mr. Eloff and draft something to change how the subdivision reads and so on, and that's just going to be late. And I was just going to suggest an oral amendment to change January 15th, 2010 to December 15th, 2009. So that we can just get stuff in the form we need to have.
Okay.
Like,
and
Representative Taylor, like the Christmas off or something.
So, and Representative Taylor, you want to make a comment to that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At one point that December 15th was being looked at, but we weren't sure if that would actually be enough time to get the report together. And since in the second year we don't actually start out right in January, we thought that would perhaps, give sufficient time. But, I don't know if anyone else is opposed to or in favor of, I guess, of moving that date. But that was initially why that date ends up January 15th, to give adequate time, and yet realizing that we wouldn't be in session yet anyway.
Okay. And Representative Gardner?
Yeah, that mm-hmm. sounds like a great change, Representative Gardner and the Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move an oral amendment on line 1.23 to delete January 15th, 2010, and replace with and insert December 15th, 2009.
Okay, Representative Gardner moves that on line 1.23 strike January 15th, 2010, and insert December 15th, 2009. Any discussion?
I was just going to say, Mr. Chair, you can call it the Ms. Taylor, Mr. Eloff Identity Protection Act, so that we don't jam up everything now, next year.
Okay, all those in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Any further questions? Okay, one more oral amendment that we'll have Ms. Taylor explain for us.
Mr. Chair, members, on the written language, on the A3, we need to add a letter D and to signify a new paragraph so that that language is added to the statutory language on the original House File 2117.
All right, that sounds great. Thank you for that.
So could you explain where that would go, the D?
Yeah, the D would be right in front of the first the of the written language.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay. Everybody understand the oral amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. And the amendment is adopted. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, Representative Sterner removes his motion that House File 2117, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails and the bill is passed. Moving on to next bill, Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 2154 be approved and passed on to the Environment Finance Committee.
Representative Saylor moves that House File 2154 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. And Representative Saylor to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Keeping in mind this is the last bill, we'll be fairly brief here. But this bill is to help the state and the counties and other local governments work on reducing the amount of organic material going into the landfills. It's certainly been brought to the attention of a number of us that the local governments oftentimes have trouble, you know, beginning or getting a good organics program going. Also, schools are interested in reducing the amount of organic waste, food waste specifically, that hauled to landfills, and they often need the assistance and help that grant program would provide to them. This grant program would run through the PCA as a standard grant program do run. And the projects that are eligible are those that would be reducing costs for hauling waste, reducing food waste and other organics that enter the mixed municipal solid waste stream, increasing opportunities in general, increasing the educational opportunities, and also reaching out to some groups that maybe traditionally haven't looked at some of the grabbing opportunities through the PCA, that being soil and water districts and school districts, possibly even wage associations as well, that often have an interest in promoting composting. And I guess I will just try to be very brief here. So these are opportunities that can be used around the state. I have one testifier here who has been very patiently waiting with the soil and water districts, and the other testifier, which I was hoping would be here earlier, and he had to cancel. I would like to say a few remarks on his behalf, and it isn't Mark Gamm, who couldn't be here either, but it's Gary Noreen, who works with Chisago County, and he is currently working on a project there with the schools on reducing their food waste. And when he learned that I had this bill that would potentially help schools to work on some of their waste problems, he was very, very interested in that. Since he's currently working on that, he was sorry he could not be here, but he did want me to mention to you that he is very interested in a bill that will help the school. He's long been working with many entities within Chisago County, and currently it's the schools. But right now, maybe I could turn it over to Leanne Buck.
Ms. Buck, welcome. If you could state your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leanne Buck. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts. We just appreciate the opportunity to be included in the legislation that would allow local soil and water districts to compete for the grant. Soil and water districts work with school districts, county government, local government, nonprofit, lake associations. So it's a nice fit to include this to protect our natural resources as well as some soil quality issues that we're very interested in. So we see this as an opportunity to engage different people and our local soil and water districts as well.
Thank you, Ms. Buck. Any questions at all for Representative Saylor or Ms. Buck? Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Saylor or Ms. Buck, is this a grant that will go to the Soil and Water Conservation District? Will this help you compete with the for-profit compost people, or will you potentially utilize them to better get our organic waste from public institutions to be composted?
We wouldn't be competing. It'd be maybe a way to encourage work with school districts, and again, we wouldn't be trying to compete, and we'd be very open.
Okay. Any other questions? Representative Gardner.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative Saylor, the appropriation goes through the end of fiscal year 2011, and I think that ends June 30th, 2011. And then you want to report by January 1, 2014. Would you be amenable to having that date be moved way earlier so that we can measure a little earlier?
And Representative Saylor.
Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Gardner, for catching that. Yes, certainly be moved up.
Mr. Chair, my suggestion would be December 15th, 2011, because the money would be finished by June 30th, 2011, and then PCA can report by the end of the year.
Okay. And Representative Taylor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And
Shall I move that?
I have no problem with that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'll move oral amendments on page 2, line 19, to delete January 1, 2014, and insert December 15th, 2011.
Okay. Representative Gardner moves that on line 2.19 strike January 1st, 2014 and insert December 15th, 2011. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Representative Virginia.
Local
administration of the program. After the comma, I
would insert the word have measurable outcomes. And you can emphasize local administration, but I think you must have measurable outcomes.
Would that be acceptable to the author?
Hey, Representative
Taylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Virginia. Yes, that would make sense.
Okay. And with that, Representative Virginia moves it on line 2.1, after the comma, insert have. Any discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted.
Aye.
Any other discussion? Seeing none, Representative Saylor renews her motion that House File 2154, as amended, be recommended to pass to the Committee on Finance with the intention that it go to Environment Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion prevails. Bill is passed. Yes, a reminder for everyone, for the members, that we will not be meeting on Tuesday. We will meet again next Thursday to consider the Senate bills that have come over. So with that, meeting is adjourned.